In the past, politicians promised to create a better world. They had different ways of achieving this, but their power and authority came from the optimistic visions they offered their people. Those dreams failed, and today people have lost faith in ideologies. Increasingly, politicians are seen simply as managers of public life. But now, they have discovered a new role that restores their power and authority. Instead of delivering dreams, politicians now promise to protect us from nightmares. They say that they will rescue us from dreadful dangers that we cannot see and do not understand. And the greatest danger of all is international terrorism, a powerful and sinister network with sleeper cells in countries across the world. A threat that needs to be fought by a war on terror. But much of this threat is a fantasy, which has been exaggerated and distorted by politicians. It's a dark illusion that has spread unquestioned through governments around the world, the security services, and the international media.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 13th of October 2023. What an excellent day. Friday the 13th, a very good day when the Knights Templar were arrested back in 1307. And so that's today. People sometimes think it's not an auspicious day. It most definitely is an auspicious day. It wasn't very good for Philip the Fair, who had them arrested. But for the planet, understanding exactly who the Templars were, it was brilliant. And of course, we are now dealing with a similar thing to the Crusades, with this military base that the West set up after World War II. The Brits, of course, playing a massive role in all of that after the Second World War. We're streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please don't use the Google Play Store to find another one. In fact, this is the store where I found the Rumble app, because Google had blocked it at the time of the Russell Brand business. It's just linked from our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Lovely little non-Google Play app store, which with all the Android apps on there, to bypass and avoid Google, which of course is just a front for the National Security Agency, as we all know. On this show, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, and cancelling the vote winners like Boris and Trump, whilst Big Pharma's Matt Hancock and Bill Gates' crimes against humanity are supposed to be all forgotten, because the evil Putin and, of course, the evil Hamas now are also taking over the news agenda, helping us navigate us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We're joined later, I hope, also by Pastor Diarmuid Lee, talking about being cancelled, basically, by the Bristol police, being told, don't talk about this, don't talk about that, and certainly don't read the Bible out in public. Otherwise, you know, you might start hate crimes. First part of the show this week, we'll be looking at the party conference, the Labour conference this time, mainly, and in part two, Gaza, and particularly looking at this attack last Saturday with various guests. So Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. We cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here quite yet. So Martin, just starting on the party conference this week, last week it was the Tories, this week Labour. Impressed?
Well, it was pretty much what I expected. You know, there's no real surprises, is it?
That's no, is it?
Well, no, it's not. The party conference at this stage of the game, from the point of view of the party leadership, is all about the next general election. And from their point of view, they were fairly happy with it. I don't particularly agree with the programme that they've put together. But then, you know, it ain't up to me, is it?
What would you be doing?
Well, I mean, I think Rachel Reeves is basically being playing very, very safe. And it's not just me saying this. Lots of people are saying, you know, we need a bit more radicalism here, determination to sort of break the mould. But, of course, the thinking within the Labour leadership is we can't afford to promise too much, and we've got to actually get people to understand that we're not going to do anything much, otherwise they're going to be on our case. And, of course, the real issue will turn up when the economy turns down. They mustn't turn towards austerity. So I think she will find, when she becomes the Chancellor, which it looks as if she will, that she will not be able to cut public expenditure, and she won't be able to stop it increasing either.
Well, Rachel
She
Reeves,
will say at the moment that she will, but she won't be able to.
She's Shadow Chancellor. She was with Keir Starmer over at Davos, saying how much better they were than the British Parliament earlier this year. And she's also Jewish. She led the Zionist, one of the handful of people in the Labour Party that led the Zionist campaign against the pro-Palestinian and so-called anti-Semitic Jews, and basically purged them from the party.
Well, I didn't realise that she was actually Jewish, but it wouldn't surprise me. She's very much on the right wing of the Labour Party. She used to work for the Bank of England. She's a very safe pair of hands as far as mainstream, you know, what we might call financial interests are concerned. And it's easy to mock, but Labour governments do have to have some kind of dealings with the city, if you like. John McDonnell, when he was the Shadow Chancellor, he went and had various meetings with the city to try and square them up with what the policy was going to be. And she's obviously, you know, she's got to do that as well. I don't begrudge that. But I think the idea that any kind of austerity is justifiable in these circumstances is wrong. We need to massively increase spending. I'm sure Justin will agree with me later. Massive increase in public spending is absolutely essential.
Just to correct myself, she isn't Jewish, but she is a leading figure in the Labour Friends of Israel.
Well, that wouldn't at all surprise me, as is Keir Starmer. So there we are.
Yeah, she went to Cater Park School, which was down the road from me when I was growing up. It was known to be a very, very rough school. That's no reason why a good politician can't come from a rough school. But she seems like the sort of person who is much more interested in being in the clique, being very friendly with the lobbyists. And it seems to me that now the whole political system has got very little to do with what voters want. And it's all about the politicians being bought and captured by lobbyists.
That is true, but don't forget that the voters themselves aren't necessarily radical. And therefore, if you want to win, especially under a first-past-the-post system, you've got to win those marginal constituencies, which means you can't say anything too much to frighten the horses. We need to change the system so we're going to have a proper conversation.
Why does changing the system make any difference? Because it looks like Labour are going to win.
Yes, I know, but it's the wrong kind of Labour. If we had in Spain, the left has won just about by a whisker, but the Sanchez, who is to the left of Starmer, cannot form a government without Yolanda Díaz and the left of Spanish politics. So the left in Spain will be in the government, but they won't control the government. And that's what happens in civilised countries. In this country, we will be stuck with a Labour Party run from the top by the right wing, and anything to the left of that will be squashed. And that's the system. And it's designed to keep us out. And we know it's designed to keep us out. And that's why in other countries of the United Kingdom, people have changed the system, because it's obvious what's going on.
Rachel Reeves has vowed to rebuild Britain. How is she going to do that? And can she afford it?
What she's saying is she's going to rebuild Britain, but she's not going to spend any money, which is wrong. And she's saying, there will be growth in the economy, and that's where we're going to get the money from. That is wrong as well, because unless you spend public, and I'm sure Justin's going to agree with me later from PCS, unless you spend money into the economy, it doesn't grow. And that's the truth. That's the actual factual way in which economies work.
Well, how does she intend to grow the economy without spending any money into it?
She just presumes capitalism just does it on its own.
Well, this is a bit worrying, isn't it? A lot of Labour people now seem to have become Tories in thinking that just by subsidising and bolstering business and the wealthy, that the wealth will somehow trickle down.
Well, that's right, and that's precisely what's wrong with where she's coming from. And after everything we've been through in the last decade, it's pretty pathetic. But when she comes to power, she'll find that she can't do that, because if she tries not to spend money, the economy will start going down, and she'll then have to spend money in order to stop it going down, and the pressure will be on her from the trade unions and others. Look, you can't just crash the economy to fulfill your silly targets of keeping public expenditure.
Well, before we hear from the girl from Cater Park School in Lewisham, what about this whole business of the Labour Friends of Israel and her enormous impact that she had back in the Corbyn era and after in making sure that all pro-Palestinian people within the Labour Party were purged?
Well, I mean, we know what's going on. The Israel lobby spends, I mean, the Al Jazeera sting on Shaim Moffat, or whatever his name was.
Shaim Assot, the political attaché at the Israeli embassy. Yeah.
He was basically saying, we've got £1 million to spend to make sure the Labour Party does what we want. Mm. And she was not, and Joan, whatever her name was nodding along going, yes, yes, that sounds good. Now, so in other words, the Labour Party depends on money, and, you know, I've paid my sub since 1975, and all mounts up.
So the way it works is, as soon as someone comes along waving pound notes, they say, yeah, well, what do you want from us? And then they
I think it's more to the point that the Israelis want stuff from them, and these people are pro-Israel anyway, and they're just being given the means to fulfil what they...
It's like putting a sort of rocket engine up their backside and off they go into stellar... Well, I mean, it's obviously, you know, being Shadow Chancellor is a very key position. Anyway, let's have a listen to Rachel Reeves's a report on her now about her plans. This is from Channel 4 News, I think, this one, about how she plans to rebuild Britain at her speech at the party conference in Liverpool earlier this week.
Corporate Britain has turned up in its thousands to take a look at Keir Starmer's Labour Party. And the Shadow Chancellor's message for them and for the voters is peppered with phrases long at the heart of Conservative Party conference speeches.
A Labour government will not waver from ironclad fiscal rules. I didn't come into politics to raise taxes on working people. Indeed, I want them to be lower. Responsibility must always come first. Labour will wage a war against fraud, waste and inefficiency.
Rachel Reeves said Labour would spend more on day-to-day services when there was economic growth and speeded up planning on infrastructure and housing for the sort of measures that would help that happen.
Labour is the party of the builders, not the blockers. Labour is the party of economic growth. And it is now beyond doubt. It is Labour that is the party of home ownership in Britain today.
But much of the speech had been a raid on the Tory lexicon. And when she finished, Rachel Reeves raided George Osborne's contacts file as well and played an endorsement from Mark Carney, the man he made Bank of England governor.
Rachel Reeves is a serious economist. She began her career at the Bank of England, so she understands the big picture. But crucially, she also understands the economics of work, of place, and of family. It's beyond time to put her ideas and energy into action.
The plan he endorsed could mean public services don't get new cash fast under Labour.
If it's really a case of we're waiting for growth before spending goes up, given that current spending plans are really very tight, that is going to mean that on the whole public services are not going to improve at any dramatic pace.
Businesses have flooded into this conference. It's not to everyone's taste.
I think you'll see the way in which influences go on here this weekend in Liverpool when there's no end of corporate lobbyists hanging around the Labour Party conference, as indeed they hang around and invite people into their many feeding troughs around Westminster.
Do you get echoes of New Labour, the 1990s?
Some echoes of 96, 97. But here's the difference between the...
There's no hope now.
No, there is a lot of hope, but that hope has to be combined with realism.
You must feel you've got your party back.
Well, the party went on a walkabout under Jeremy Corbyn. We have now switched the party back from weird to normal.
Under Jeremy Corbyn, the conference floor could be a sea of Palestinian flags.
Labour supports Israeli apartheid.
Today, a small demonstration outside the secure zone and inside a minute's silence for the victims of the Hamas attacks.
If you could join us in a moment's silence.
So that's Gary Gibbons' report on Channel 4 News. Excellent roundup, I thought. And so much in there. I mean, the appearance of Peter Mandelson, let's start with that.
Well, these people are cock-a-hoop that they finally got back what they wanted in the first place. And you feel like saying to them, do you remember that you invaded Iraq and started all these wars in the Middle East, and that's why the Liberal Democrats took your votes and why you couldn't win an election? Do you remember that? And of course they don't. They've forgotten all about that. They think that was just an aberration.
Mandelson is actually a major figure in all of this, isn't he? He was known as the Prince of Darkness amongst the reporters in London for many years, and still is.
Well, he is. I mean, you can't say that these people haven't a right to exist. The political spectrum is going to have everybody in it.
Well,
isn't
he had to resign twice because of corruption,
yes.
Didn't he?
Yes. I mean, basically, he is.
Lord Mandelson.
Yeah, well, there you are. So we're talking about people who are very much the establishment, and the establishment is quite happy with having a Labour government because they don't feel in any way threatened by what Labour will do.
Mark Carney saying, yes, I very much approve of the Labour Party. I endorse Rachel Reeves, and at some point in the future there may be a return to strong economic growth, at which point they can start to spend money, but not before.
Well, that's simply economically illiterate in my book, because if they don't spend money, the economy isn't going to grow. They've got the idea that capitalism somehow spontaneously regenerates. So when you go into a crisis or a crash, as we're going to now, that's where we are, if the government tries to cut back public expenditure, it won't grow. This idea that if we just leave the economy alone, it will grow, and if we try and do anything, it won't grow, is simply wrong. Keynes argued decisively against that in 1936 in the General Theory, and nothing since has changed that view. It's absolutely neoliberal twaddle. The idea that when the deflationary pressures of the debt deflation in the economy kick in, the only thing you can do is increase public expenditure. You're forced to increase it anyway, because as the economy goes down, tax receipts go down and benefit payments automatically go up. So it'll be very interesting to see if she can bring public expenditure down or keep it on a level, because she won't be able to. The economy doesn't work like that. People think it does, and therefore when Mandelson goes about realism, that's what he's talking about. Everybody thinks, well, we all know we can't spend what we haven't got, but in actual fact, it doesn't work like that. And the Russians know that, and the Chinese know that. They don't work, they don't run
like that.
Well,
actually, the Labour Party used to know that.
That's right.
We've also got, a statement she made, you heard in that clip there, I want tax on working people to be lower. Well, she's making no commitments that it will be.
Yes, and in any case, taxes on working people could easily be lower if you change the taxation system to tax wealth and inheritance and so on. And that's, yeah, you shouldn't really tax profits or wages. It should be property wealth and capital gains. You can get all the money you need from capital gains. And that's a much more efficient way to run things. And of course, that's a radical position, but she is actually staking out a non-radical position. We're not going to be as nasty as the Tories, but we are Tories. That's all it's saying.
And wait for growth. Is that growth going to never... You're saying it's never going to come.
I'm saying...
Unless they spend, that growth is never going to come.
That's right. They will. The economy will not grow unless they invest and
what's happened
give it a
is,
push.
And both
when
businesses
the car's
and families,
down, you've got to give it a push,
both,
you know.
Both businesses and families are now overwhelmed with overheads, aren't they, basically?
That's right.
So you haven't got hardly any spending power. That is to say, rents, mortgages...
That's right.
Electricity bills, fuel bills for the car to get to work, public transport bills... All these things are at an all-time high. And so how can there be growth in the economy when just literally to stand still, people are having to pay through the nose?
That's right. And in actual fact, she probably will win the election because they're a better bet than the other shower. But what will happen when she comes...
Well, they're a less worse bet.
That's right. That's all we're saying, really. But the point is, when she comes to power, she will say, we are not going to spend money on public services. Obviously, people working in public services won't be very happy with that. But by not spending money, she could give the, you know, teachers, doctors, you know, care workers a big pay rise. And that would make the economy grow. If you don't do that, it won't. Because in actual fact, having loads of wealthy people at the top who don't spend their money, they invest in property speculation, and of course the property market's wobbling, there's going to be a downturn when they come to power, which is very different from 1997 because the economy was ticking over. Now they're going to inherit a downturn. Now in a downturn, you can't keep public expenditure down. You can try, but you won't succeed. Osborne tried, and he couldn't succeed because you can't do it. Until the economy, until you put some oomph in the economy with public spending, it won't grow.
Bernie Ecclestone, you know, talking about people with money, is just being done for fraud, for hiding wealth. Interesting, he's an interesting character, Ecclestone, isn't he? I think, am I right in saying he was believed to be a getaway driver for the Great Train Robbery, and then he was elevated to this position of the boss of Formula One?
Well, I don't know. I haven't looked very in full detail into his background, but yes, I have heard some similar rumours.
But isn't it interesting? I think, you know, some these members of the establishment, they put a foot wrong and suddenly they're being prosecuted. We look at Bernie Ecclestone and say, oh, there is justice. At least there is justice. But I don't doubt that he's politically, you know, said something wrong.
Well, he's basically, you know, he's got caught this time, but in actual fact, he's loads of other things he's done he hasn't been caught for. I mean, that's the only thing that crosses my mind. I mean, they're all basically corrupt. Him especially. And therefore, you know, if they get caught, it's just, I mean, basically being caught like this and being forced to pay up to the tax man is, an overhead of doing business. If he was sent to prison for evading tax, then that would be a deterrent, wouldn't it? But that's not what's happening.
No, he's got a, suspended sentence.
Well, there you are. So he's not going to prison.
Anyway, it'd be nice to. Has anyone got any idea why it was Ecclestone was prosecuted? Because I just don't honestly believe
it. May be that they just got caught. It's not every prosecution is going to have an agenda.
As you know, the elite are protected. Something he has said or done has meant he's not protected. I'll be working on that one while we have a listen to Keir Starmer, his speech. Actually, no. Before we hear the great crescendo of his conference speech, let's hear again Channel 4 News, I think. It's Starmer. Okay, and we heard a little bit there from Rachel Reeves about this, but planning is a big thing, isn't it? They're going to try and tear up all the rules to do with planning to get as many houses of these hideous little Legoland houses that are so-called affordable houses with no gardens, that sort of thing, built as possible.
Well, we shall see whether they're able to do that. The property market is basically on the ropes. So if they imagine that people are going to rush forward and build loads of stuff when the property market's on the ropes, is absurd. I mean, basically, the property developers don't want to build anything much anymore because the property market's on the ropes. How are you going to stop that unless you're going to spend some money?
One of the things that Ecclestone has done, by the way, is he was very much pushing for there to be a Formula One, part of the Formula One competition should take place in Russia, going against the idea of having sanctions on Russia. So that might be one of the reasons that he was has been prosecuted. I don't honestly believe in the British justice system anymore at all. I think particularly major figures, they have to do something to upset the establishment before there's any chance of them being prosecuted at all. And, of course, the Labour leader, Sir Keir Starmer, is a big part of all of that, having been the Director of Public Prosecutions, who failed to prosecute Jimmy Savile twice. In fact, through the evidence that Surrey Police gave him in the bin twice, and also was doing flights to the States and doing everything he possibly could to make sure that when he was Director of Public Prosecutions that Julian Assange was kept in jail, even though he's not committed any crime. So that's Mr. Starmer for you. So let's have a listen about his plans to bulldoze through the planning system.
I want to ask you about planning. Is it the case that if a community really doesn't want a great big new housing development, maybe even an entire new town in its district, you'll listen, but in the end, they might have to lump it?
We have to listen, of course, and what I want to do is to try and ensure that we get the right development in the right place.
Everybody always wants that.
Yes, of course, but of course we will come up against resistance. No end of people who say, yes, I want to build a better Britain. Yes, I know young people need a house that they can buy, but don't do it here. And we will have to bulldoze through that. We will have to be prepared to take difficult decisions. Now, I actually think that most communities do want housing, as long as it's the right housing in the right place.
People have always
said that,
haven't
they? They need to know the infrastructure is in the right place, the hospitals, the schools that are needed.
But you know as well, don't you, that the although there's an affordability crisis as well as a shortage crisis in housing all over the country, it's at its most intense in the south and the southeast. And what you're really talking about is putting in houses in the Buckinghamshires, the Bedfordshires, quite topically, maybe around Cambridge, the M1 corridor. That's where most of this is going to go. That's just what everybody who studies housing says. Those are the people who should brace themselves, aren't they?
Well, I think the housing needs to be across the whole of the country, and we will be inviting bids for our new towns. But just to come to your question, within those areas, there are many what I call grey belts, which is areas that are technically within the green belt, but they're disused car parks, they're wastelands.
Absolutely.
But they're not being used at the moment, and they should be.
Can I ask you about a different point? You're very clear that you want to borrow to invest, but not for everyday spending if you're in power. But, where Streeting's just been talking about the crisis in the NHS, there are schools that could go bankrupt soon, let alone many councils, hospitals as well. What happens in the first 2 to 3 years of a Labour government when you're waiting for economic growth to happen, but you don't want to borrow to help the running costs of these public services? It looks like it's going to be beyond grim.
But we have to have, and do have, strong fiscal rules. If we've learned one thing in the last 12 months, we learned from Liz Truss, if you make unfunded spending commitments, you lose control of the economy, and it's working people who pay. Their mortgages have gone up. Everything they want to buy, their weekly, monthly shops have gone up because of the damage to the economy. I'm not prepared to even countenance that for a Labour government.
It's going to be very, very tough. You're going to be waiting for growth, hoping it comes. It never comes that quickly. You could be waiting for years as Prime Minister, and these services could be top of the limit.
I think we can go at speed on growth. Most investors are saying to me, global investors are saying, we do have money to invest. We're just not prepared to invest in the UK whilst it's chopping and changing, where you see the chaos, changing prime ministers, changing positions. That's why we need the stability. We can put the hope on top of that and we can go at speed. But of course, it's going to be a very hard start because of the mess that the Conservatives have made of our country.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, you can see the pitch he's trying to make there. It's for global investors to invest in Britain because, you know, we're going to have stability rather than chaos that we've had, which is quite a good line to take in terms of winning elections, but whether it's any good when you get there is another matter.
Does he mean political stability? I mean, he's obviously talking about the Boris Johnson leadership challenge last year, that sort of thing, but I can't necessarily see that the Labour Party is likely to keep any kind of, constant policy any more or less than the Tories are.
Well, they're not in.
Maybe we don't have a Liz Truss.
Right. I mean, we've got a very low bar to beat there, if you think about it. You can see that business people are going to say, well, that's the sort of thing we want to hear. Maybe we will. I think this talk about building houses in the southeast of England is rubbish. I mean, how is that going to help the housing crisis? You know, and all the emphasis upon we've got to get young people buying houses again. It's like, what are you talking about? We just need houses. Some of them can be, you know, the way the council house system used to work was that people who were on the margins of being capable of buying a house went into council housing, which was just as good a choice. You know, it was a 50-50 choice for them. And that made buying houses cheaper. But you had to have a very substantial social rented sector. Now, that is the obvious solution to the problem. And he could actually say, that's what we're going to do. We're going to build council houses for poorer people. And that's going to solve that problem. We're not necessarily, we don't really want another property bubble in the southeast of England. That's stupid. We don't need that. There's no point to it. It actually makes the economy even more unbalanced than all the rest of it. But you can see he's just going with the flow of the existing setup and hoping to tweak a few things. Now you can see why that might be attractive to your middle of the road floating voter, but it's just wrong because the global economy is about to go into the biggest crisis since World War II, and that kind of tinkering will just not cut the mustard, in my view.
So just trying to bring some of this housing business down to ground level. More than 60 people in Bristol being evicted after a rogue landlord was banned by the council. Tenants have been served with eviction papers in a situation the landlord has described as ridiculous and unfair. The young people and families in properties owned by a, inverted commas, rogue landlord say they're facing homelessness after the council secured a banning order against her. The tenants of an estimated 21 properties have been issued with Section 21 no-fault eviction notices, requiring them to be out of their homes by the 1st of December. after legal action against the owner of the homes, Naomi Knapp, by Bristol City Council. She's been branded a rogue landlord and announced last August they'd secured a banning order against her, successfully defended that ban against an appeal, and in late May this year, back then, the council reassured people living in her home so the banning order did not mean they will need to leave their properties. The end result, less than 5 months later, is all the tenants will now have to go. So this is not very clever by the council, is it, necessarily? They are trying maybe to do the right thing, but they haven't really thought it through. So they're saying this is a bad landlord, but the end result is far worse for the tenants who are now being evicted.
Well, that is the problem. And, of course, what's going to happen to private rented tenants like me when this crisis comes to a head is what happened after the 2008 crash. We're all going to be booted out. Now, the government, if it wants to do something about this, needs to build council houses. Get on with it. And stop talking, and of course we can then tweak what's happening in the private rented sector by changing the rules. Changing the rules overnight to make the private rented sector more regulated leads to a situation where they either voluntarily, the landlords, buy-to-let landlords, leave the market, or they just boot everybody out and sell all their properties, which is what's happened here. We shouldn't be in this place. We shouldn't be here. But the idea that building more Bovis homes around Cambridge is the solution is bovine.
It doesn't seem like, I mean, go back to my main point. Have the council not thought this through? By banning her from being a landlord, that means that she needs to sell those houses and she would be obviously evicting her tenants.
Yeah, but what they're thinking is we're going to set the logic behind is we're going to set a floor here under what landlords can and can't do in Bristol. And that, of course, there was also the idea that, you know, people will see that we're doing something about this. But the problem is, as you say, the mess is too complicated for that. What they need to do, actually, is that there should be compulsory purchase on these landlords. They should just be bought out by the state. But where's the money going to come from that for that sort of thing, since we can't spend any money?
Well, that's why it's not going to happen. All the repairs on the homes I was taken to the tribunal for, she says, have now been fixed. There were more than 20 other homes I rent out that didn't have any problems. Why is the council pursuing this? They are crazy, basically, is in a nutshell, she's saying.
Well, I tend to agree. But, I mean, we shouldn't be in the situation where people are in these buy-to-let sets of situations anyway. There should be social housing available to everybody, and that's what used to be the case, and it was okay, it worked, but we got rid of it
anyway. Of course, this is all going to be sorted out by this wonderful new Labour government coming in next year, and let's have a listen to leader Keir Starmer this week's party conference, his crescendo ending to his great conference speech.
Let the message from Rutherglen ring out across Britain. Labour serves working people in Scotland because Labour serves working people across all these islands. There's nothing more important. No distractions. No higher cause. That's who we stand for. What we stand for. Our argument for Britain. An old partnership, perhaps, but a flame now reignited to face a modern age of insecurity. A Britain once again united by the solidarity of working people, staring down the challenges of a more volatile world, fighting for our future together. And conference, it will be a fight. The SNP will regroup. Of course they will. Once again, they will wave away the lessons of history, try to present nationalism as a bridge to the world. We have to remind them it can barely provide a ferry out of the Hebrides. As for the Tories, I have to warn you, a party that has so completely severed its relationship with the future, that is prepared to scorch the earth just to get at us, they will be dangerous. Trust me, wherever you think the line is, they've already got plans to cross it. But they'll be up for the fight. They're always up for the fight to save their own skins. And this isn't over. In fact, it's barely begun. So we have to be disciplined, focused, ready to fight back, and confident, conference, because we have come so far already. We've dragged this party back to service, and we can do the same for politics. I grew up working class. I've been fighting all my life, and I won't stop now. I've felt the anxiety of a cost of living crisis before, and until your family can see the way out, I will fight for you. That's my mission, and we will do it. We will face down the age of insecurity, break the stranglehold of Tory decline, walk towards a decade of national renewal. Conference. Why Labour? Because we serve your interests. Why Labour? Because we will grow every corner of our country. Why Labour? Because we have a plan to take back our streets, switch on great British energy, get the NHS back on its feet, tear down the barriers to opportunity and get Britain building again. A plan for a Britain built to last, a plan to heal the wounds, a plan to turn the page and say, in a cry of defiance to all those who now write our country off, Britain must, Britain can, Britain will get its future back. Thank you, conference. Thank you, conference. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, conference. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, would you buy a used car from this guy?
Just speaking as a kind of, you know, rhetorical flourish. You know, what does that sound like? It sounds like he wants it to sound like. The Labour Party people who are in there clapping and cheering want to win
there's
the election.
No, look, there's no detail.
It's no, just of course the basic, there's no detail.
It's the he's saying the... we will get our country yes. back. We yes. will get our future back. Look, he's talking about restoring the NHS. Does he mean more privatisation? Because that's the only way, I think, that... I mean, if he's not going to be spending any money on it, then that's the only way, surely.
Well, we've passed this already when he was interviewed by the Channel 4 person. This is a speech at the end of a party conference to rally the troops to win an election. And he's trying to reach out to people beyond the Labour Party to say, look, I'm the kind of guy this is the kind of guy I am, and all of that stuff. It's PR, and of course PR does matter. Because people, not many people are that interested in politics to listen to a show like this every week. They, you know, they pick up various bits and bobs from the media, and they are the swing voters in the marginal constituencies.
Well, it's just, I think it's just absolutely riddled with cliches. I don't think most people who have no interest in politics would take it seriously either.
Well, I mean, the trust me one, you know, they all come out with that, don't they? Trust me. And as soon as somebody says that, I think, nah.
Well, especially a politician or a journalist, you know, I just honestly think it's, when we heard the, is it Penny Mordaunt's AI chatbot speech last week, you know, this is the same, I think the problem here is we don't have any statesmen left. I mean, if it was the Heath Wilson era, you would have had a far, far more detailed look. I understand the way the country runs, this is the way it's going wrong, and this is what I'm going to literally straight away, first day I get in, I'm going to be doing this and this and this to fix it. But there's none of that at all. It's just, like I say, just cliches.
I have to tell you, Tony, that always politics has been strewn with cliches, because in actual fact, you've got to be very careful not to say the wrong thing. Otherwise, there are problems further down the line.
This does also seem to be a major sort of policy plank of Labour, is to say nothing about what you can plan to... Because, I mean, they don't really have to do anything to win.
Well, that's right. So they don't want to give any hostages to fortune, and that's what they're not going to do that, are they? I mean, I am a member of the Labour Party, and I expect to vote for them. And therefore, I'm not, you know, as far as it goes... Okay, but of course, in actual fact, they haven't got a real policy, as you pointed out, because they haven't confronted the fact that capitalism is dead. So the idea that we're going to get growth and then we're going to sort it all out is simply wrong. They're going to have to work with other countries to reform the capitalist system in a fundamental way. And there's no hint of any of that in there at all. And of course, they're going to run smack dab into a massive crisis. So the idea that it's all just going to settle down and then they're going to get to work is just wrong. They're going to get a baseball bat in the teeth on day one.
Well, so the whole system seems to be being paralysed. by big business, by cartels, you know, the same sort of people that were around in the United States just before the Second World War, who were planning a coup against the government.
Well, basically, we've got a neoliberal deep state that blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is going to plunge the whole of Europe into a depression. Is anybody in the mainstream talking about that? That's way outside the Overton window, Tony, isn't it? Now, the Overton window is full of all these people who watch mainstream news. And most people, if you talk to them now, did you know the Americans blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline? They'd look at you blankly. A, they've forgotten about it. B, the cost of living crisis has been caused by exactly that. It's our war with Russia that's caused the cost of living crisis. So nobody wants to talk about that.
Well, I don't know about that. I think it's also deliberate price fixing that's caused
it. Yes, but that's deliberate price fixing goes on anyway. But you know, underlying all
well,
of that.
It's a convenient cover, isn't it? Just for jacking up everything.
Yes, I know. But at the same time, Tony, there are fundamental
and
things
also, you know, we're
not
we're
being discussed
to,
in the mainstream
yes,
at
true,
all.
But we are starting to have to get much of our energy in Europe from the United States. And the United States would rather we were paying an extra 15, 20 or even 50% more for that energy. That's rather good for them.
It's more than that we're going to be paying. And, of course, this is what's so disgusting about the blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. It's one of the biggest terrorist attacks in history. It's going to plunge the whole of Europe, including Britain, because we're in Europe, whether we like it or not, into chaos, and we're going to have massive unemployment. And you've got people in the mainstream, nobody's allowed to talk about any of this. The next election will not be about the war in the Ukraine. It won't be about Hamas. It will be about cost of living crisis, which is, of course, about exactly those things. But nobody can talk about it. And the mainstream media keep people in the dark about what's really going on. Shows like this chip away, but at the end of the day, most people, most of the time, just pick up the mainstream stuff.
So you're talking about Nord Stream. What about Baltic Connector?
Well, that's interesting,
oh,
isn't
dear.
It?
What a shot. Something funny happened there this week. This is a pipeline between
Finland
and
Estonia.
Both state-run companies own and operate the Baltic Connector pipeline. Damage appeared to be caused by mechanical force. It may have been a deliberate act. So is this a gas pipeline? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I'm just having a look. So anyway, what do you make of that?
Well, it could be the...
It's a gas pipeline.
Yeah, it could be the Russians showing, hey, your pipelines could be... You know, we could do nasty stuff to your pipelines. I don't think it is, because if the Russians wanted to do nasty stuff to the pipelines, they wouldn't do something like this, which is relatively minor. If you're going to take all the opprobrium for knackering somebody's pipeline, you go for the jugular, which is exactly what the Americans did with Nord Stream 2. That's taking out Germany's jugular vein. And if you're going to do stuff like that, you don't mess around, do you?
Isn't it sort of in a slightly similar area in the Baltic, isn't it?
Well, that's right. So, in other words, you could argue that this is an attempt to sort of, oh, the Russians are doing tit-for-tat and all the rest. But also, if you think about it, it just muddies the waters about who's blowing pipelines up in the Baltic. I mean, you know, the world and his dog know that the US blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. But if other pipelines start getting blown up very mysteriously, then it all becomes, oh, well,
Finland's,
gosh, nobody knows
Finland's
who's blowing
National
them up.
Bureau of Investigation on Wednesday this week said the external marks were found on the seabed beside the pipeline. Well, maybe it's Bigfoot down there.
Yeah, because this is not even an explosion, is it? It's something else. But, I mean, I don't know.
Anchor damage was a potential explanation.
Well, that's, you know, if it's not an explosion, it could just be something like that. And we shouldn't jump to conclusions. I don't think the Russians would go in for a silly tit-for-tat like that. It doesn't make any sense for them.
Well, it might make sense for the Americans to do it. Because,
oh, yes, that's what I'm saying. By creating this idea that the pipelines are vulnerable in the Baltic, you know the Baltic, all the pipelines.
Oh, every week another pipeline's blown up, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. So, in other words, because they have been somewhat embarrassed by the revelations about them blowing it up, which is why they came up with the cock and bull story about the Ukrainians on the yacht. As Medvedev said, there were 5 men and 1 woman. He said there's always a femme fatale in these Hollywood scripts, you know. And, you know, it has successfully, most mainstream politicians in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe have said absolutely nothing apart from Sikorsky in Poland saying thank you USA for blowing up the pipeline. So people, there's a huge amount of cognitive dissonance here. What should be happening is politicians in Europe should be turning around to the Americans and saying it's time for you to go. You can't do stuff like that to us, and we want compensation for that, and it's going to be billions and billions and billions of dollars. But we're not. They're not saying that, are they?
Well, now, as you know, I've written a book about, and I'm constantly talking about how I think that there is this Fourth Reich around, which is a survivor of the Second World War, a kind of financial empire, which was largely created by Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, over in South America by creating these 750 companies after World War II, into which the Nazi loot via Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm in New York was laundered. And it's interesting to see this week another figure that I've written about, which is Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. His Nazi Party membership card is being confirmed as authentic. Now, even though this guy is a Dutch prince, or was a Dutch prince, died a few years ago, chairman of the Bilderberg conferences for the first 20 years, it turns out, indeed, he was a signed up and paid up member of the Nazi Party.
Yeah, I think I sent you that, didn't I? Yes. And we've known all along. I mean, the current son or grandson of his is saying, well, you know, there's nothing new here. And we're just
Yeah, but hang on. This has been being denied by his family.
Oh, yes. I mean, he denied that he was a member for years. He said, I used to hang around with loads of Nazis, but I never became a member. I didn't go that far. And, of course, that was just a lie. He did. And, of course, you know, there is, when you mention the money going through Sullivan and Cromwell, what you've got to understand is that the US were big supporters of the Nazi Party. Prescott, Bush, and all these other people were supporting them. So it wasn't just a German thing. So in actual fact, the Nazis, if you like, some of them were actually Americans. Do you imagine Martin Bormann, he's a gangster, of course, would blow up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to destroy the German economy? The German Reich embedded inside the EU is firmly under the Anglo-American thumb. And they, of course, are firmly under the thumb of the Zionists, which we'll come to later in the show.
Born a minor German prince in 1911, Bernhard von Lippe-Biesterfeld married Crown Prince Juliana after meeting her at the Olympic Games in Bavaria. Just before World War II, he was known to wear a white carnation in his buttonhole, a fashion that would reportedly become a symbol of resistance to Nazi Germany. He helped organise the Dutch resistance from London, despite being a Nazi himself. I mean, in many of the bits of research that I've done, it's quite clear that this guy was a Nazi agent working actually with the British Army at the same time as the liberation of Holland. And it's one of the reasons why Operation Market Garden, the Bridge Too Far operation, failed. It's because Bernhard was involved, and actually the agent that he sent in, this guy King Kong, just before the airborne drop in Arnhem, and that whole part of Holland to liberate the country, went straight to the Abwehr and told them what was about to happen. So anyway, I spoke to our Dutch correspondent, if we can call her that, now down in Exeter, Jungle Bus Millie, about this, because she was working in Holland, actually at one of the national newspapers over there, back in 1975, when the bribery, Lockheed bribery scandal broke, where it showed that Bernhard had been taking a $1 million bribe from Lockheed and Northrop and other US arms companies in order to get the Dutch Air Force, in that case Air Force, to buy American equipment. So anyway, I had a chat to her about who is this guy Bernhard, and also a bit about what was going on in the Second World War, because obviously the Dutch people were a little bit suspicious of him as an ex-Nazi suddenly saying, oh, I'm a Dutch prince now. And and also Wilhelmina, who was Juliana's mother, who was queen at the time, so just to make it clear, Wilhelmina was queen just before World War II, and Juliana, her daughter, married this Nazi German Prince Bernhard.
Wilhelmina was in London with her entire government and all of her wealth, which she somehow, you know, managed to smuggle out. I mean, like, can you imagine if Prince Charles had to get all of his wealth together? That would take a fair bit, wouldn't it? All the Da Vinci's and the Picasso's and what have you, but somehow Wilhelmina managed to get all of her 40 million guilders worth of wealth out of the country overnight, so that they must have been ready. So she was in London with her government. Juliana and her children, so that's the future Queen Beatrix and her siblings, they had gone to Canada to keep the Crown Princess out of harm's way. And Bernhard stayed in London As I said, as head of the resistance and what have you. But Wilhelmina actually went, so there was radio, I think it was just called Radio Orange. She called on the Dutch up until 1943. She called on the Dutch to collaborate with the Germans, lest the infrastructure be damaged and, you know, just collaborate, do as they say and leave the country, you know, thriving and what have you. Meanwhile, I have a very serious hunch that Bernard actually played both sides, that his, obviously his, although in Germany he was cast as a traitor, and so was his brother. His brother was even kicked out of the army. I mean, totally disgraced. The entire family were disgraced. But I reckon that Bernard actually, as liaison, acted as liaison between the Allied and the Germans, and brokered a deal. And if you know that the bank that mostly funded the whole war machinery had the Bush family involved, you know, there was massive American corporate interest in wartime Germany. They all wanted the same thing. They all just wanted money. They wanted power. They wanted control. So I think they just convinced the Germans to down their weapons, get rid of Hitler because Hitler was the bad guy, but everything else could stay the same and evolve into the EU. And that's what we're seeing. The EU is actually the Fourth Reich. It's the Third Reich minus the weapons. Well, that's how I see it anyway.
Well, no, me too. I mean, I think what they did is they created an economic Fourth Reich. In fact, in my book, I show and recount a story where an army officer who was escorting Nuremberg Nazi officers who were on trial says that he was told by them, you know, he said, so now you have beaten us for the second time, but the next time we will win. And you won't know what's happening until it's all over.
Yeah.
So there is quite a lot of evidence that there was always a plan to take the loot of Europe after the war and create this kind of economic empire. But I mean, it does. One of the things that I dug up about Bernhard was that the Americans didn't trust him in the Second World War, and yet the British did. I mean, here we have an ex-Nazi who is basically seeing himself as in charge of the Dutch resistance during the liberation of Holland, and yet the British army decided they wanted to trust him. I mean, surely they must have known that he was a former Nazi. There are photographs around of him.
Yes.
And I mean, they knew that he was a German aristocrat who was around in Germany and was helping the rise to power of Hitler even after the Nazi Party had been taken power.
Yes. Also, the Dutch government is quite clear from telegrams, cables, did they call them cables, wires, that the Dutch government also knew that he was a Nazi and that he was indeed. And then this is not totally new, this story that's in the media now of his Nazi Party membership card having been found, because a copy of it was found a few years ago in America, wasn't it, in American archives. So it's always known. And Bernard, actually, he swore with his hand on the Bible that he was never a member of the NSDAP. Hand on the Bible, I swear I was never a member. You know, like, where do you go from there?
Okay, so that's Jungle Bus Millie there. And I went on to ask her a bit about the background to this whole business with Bernhard. I mean, the idea really is that some of the people in the British establishment must have known, and of course did know, that Prince Bernhard was a former Nazi, and yet they were letting him work with the Dutch liaison, the Dutch resistance, etc. So I asked her a bit about the background to the whole thing, because she was adamant that actually the big German cartels had been working with the American cartels, very friendly with big, powerful British companies in World War II, and that actually IG Farben, the chemical and pharmaceutical cartel, was one of the major causes of the Second World War, because they wanted to extend their cartel as far as possible. And, of course, if you look at the idea of this Fourth Reich, well, that's exactly what it is.
Other than a journalist, I've also been a pharmaceutical translator, biomedical pharmaceutical translator. And I was on to scandals, public health scandals, quite often a long time before the journalist even had it together, because I was translating it and I knew the data wouldn't add up. Also, you know, the whole argument about genetically modified organisms, the whole story about the Second World War not being true. So there were all these loose, disjointed kind of acknowledgements of, no, this isn't right, this isn't what it seems. And I could never quite cast it into a single jacket, a single coherent story of why each of those narratives was false. Until I saw a very interesting talk by Matthias Rath, and you and I have spoken about him. He's a kind of German David Icke minus the lizard stories, who details in a very well researched talk called "The EU: A Political Perspective." He details how, actually, since the discovery of salicylic acid and the patenting of it, the whole petrochemical pharma complex, because they are one and the same, has set out to own life itself, literally life itself. If you can patent something, you own it. So now, all of a sudden, I understand that genetically modified organisms, much as crops, much as there is abundant proof that the yield is much worse than in permaculture, that it's much worse for the environment, et cetera, it's not at all about all the marketing that we've received about GMO. No, it's about the ownership of the food. And so where we are now is literally just an extension of that. It's the ownership of the human being through this, whatever has been injected into people, the mRNA. They have actually forfeited, I think, the right to their DNA to the pharmaceutical companies. I think that's what the vaccination drive has been.
Well, I mean, I think a fantastic amount of injuries to people, which isn't really being talked about, is very embarrassing. I mean, for example, we had a horrific coach crash recently up in Liverpool, where the driver, 40 years old, just suffered a medical episode at the wheel and turned over the coach. Initially, the press, now I'm assuming this is the Merseyside Police press office, actually lied and said another car was involved. It wasn't. The guy just had either a stroke or a heart attack at the wheel. Now, this is becoming more and more common. Even children, suddenly just dying because it may be because of these jabs. So, you know, this seems to be this bizarre world we're being pushed into. So Matthias Rath, I think, has... You know, what you've described there is making a lot of sense to me. And also there's this guy called Greg Lance Watkins over in Chepstow who dug out some fascinating documents showing something called the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, that the European Union was actually drawn up in 1941 by the finance officers of the Nazi Party, saying that that's what they wanted in order to run occupied Europe. And of course they included Britain. They did at that point. They intended to invade Britain with Operation Sea Lion. So it does seem to me that that this has all got roots, and a lot of this stuff we're seeing now goes back to World War II. Maybe even this is the latest manifestation of the same force that the world was fighting back then.
Yes, I think so too. So the goal of this, of IG Farben, which was the the main driver, wasn't it, behind the war, was to have a united, to have a one world government, actually, ultimately, you know, with one set of rules for the entire world, to have particularly one patent office, a single patent office where all these ownership documents could be lodged, to have a single currency, and preferably also to have everybody speak the same language. Well, how many of those have come true?
So thanks very much to Jungle Bus Millie for agreeing. She's only just moved into her new place in Exeter. I just find her an absolutely fascinating, riveting person, because she's been in the heart of Dutch journalism and seen just how these things operate. And so, of course, it's no conspiracy for her to see big corporations buying up, taking over the press and this sort of thing in order to make sure they get their way, they get their narrative. And she put me onto this fascinating guy, Matthias Rath, who, a friend of ours, who comes on the show from time to time, has also used some of his stuff to help rid her of her cancer. Matthias Rath is the name of the doctor over in Germany, but he's also a fierce critic of the European Union. His representative over here in the UK is a chap called Paul Anthony Taylor, who looks at something called Big Pharma and the origins of the EU. He did a big speech down in Glastonbury a few years ago at the Andy Thomas's Glastonbury Symposium.
We have been told that the medical experiments conducted by the Nazis on concentration camp inmates were perverted experiments conducted by vicious Nazi, you know, people. Well, certainly, it is certainly true that that accounts for part of the proportion of experiments that took place. But experiments were conducted on them also using patented drugs and vaccines produced by Bayer, Herxt and other IG Farben companies. The Nuremberg trial documents make this clear. Deadly tests were conducted by Bayer employees such as this man here, Helmut Vetter, and were used to develop what went on to become the first generation of what we now call chemotherapy drugs. Do you get that? So the chemotherapy drugs today are directly descended from tests that were carried out using inmates of Auschwitz and other concentration camps as guinea pigs. We even know what these chemicals were and their numbers, their patent numbers at that time. You see, on this one here, Bayer. This is a part of the history of the war and the process that led up to the formation of what we now call the European Union. It's almost been entirely erased from history. And either I'm making this up, I've come here this afternoon with a deliberate attempt to mislead you, or there's something in here that if we want to move to a better Europe, if we want to create a better world, we have to figure it into our accounts, our understanding of what took place and how we can avoid these same mistakes occurring again. Our organisation has worked very closely with survivors of Auschwitz. They are, I can honestly say to you, among the most remarkable people that I've ever met. They are truly remarkable. I guess you'd have to be to survive something like that. We've given several conferences over the years at Auschwitz, and it's always not simply just a pleasure, but I, you know, feel deeply respectful for the work that they are doing. As they put it, never again.
So that's, yeah, slightly curtailed, but that's Paul Anthony Taylor. He's Matthias Rath's representative here in the UK. That's Matthias, R-A-T-H, Dr. Matthias Rath. You'll find his website out there. Now, Martin, he's penned this book called The Nazi Roots of the Brussels EU. Now, I know you actually are a supporter of the European Union, Britain being part of it, but you, I mean, you must recognise, surely, that there is this cartel element, particularly to the way that the European commissioners who make the laws, not the MPs, the commissioners, are appointed.
Well, the EU is essentially the civilian arm of NATO, and the EU has two, you know, the sort of positive aspects of the EU, which was an attempt to prevent future wars in Europe and to develop a kind of to prove, in other words, to kind of get over what had happened in the 19th and the 20th centuries, has been perverted completely by the US and their British allies. We're out of the EU now, but we're still telling the EU what to do via the Americans.
Are we really out of the EU?
We're not really out of it, Tony, because we still trade with them in all sorts of ways, but we can't trade as well as we did before, which is one of the reasons why our interest rate is higher than in Spain and our inflation rate is higher.
No, it's because the Bank of England have put the interest rates up deliberately.
They've put the interest rates up deliberately to protect the currency, Tony, because if they didn't do that, the currency would collapse and then the economy would collapse. And it's going to collapse anyway. And, of course, the European economy is going to
collapse. Isn't it actually quite good for the pound to go down? Say, even to parity with the euro, or even below the euro, because that would mean that British goods would be cheaper abroad.
That is the, in theory, that would happen.
That would help the British economy, surely?
No. The reason it wouldn't is because Britain hasn't got any industries to take advantage of a lower pound. Yeah? They've gone. Yeah?
Yeah. You reckon that that we should rejoin the EU? The Scots want to, don't they?
No, it's not a question of rejoining. What's going to happen now is you can see what the opinion polls show, that majority of people think it was a bad idea to leave. But everybody's sick of talking about it, Tony. I do not intend to discuss it at Christmas dinner with people. I don't suppose you do either. So what's going to happen is we will carry on. The economy will go down the drain, as we discussed earlier, not just in Britain, but across Europe. And, of course, therefore, people will be able to say, well, it's not just Britain going down the drain, it's the whole of Europe, the blowing of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and all the rest of it. And then eventually people will realise that in actual fact the single market surrounds Britain. Every other country in Europe is in it. And of course the government has already decided that we're not going to have a different size of screws from everybody else in Europe. And if that was the point of leaving the EU, so we could have different size of screws, well, that's not going to happen.
But it wasn't the point, was it? Britain should regain control of its industrial policy, but that hasn't happened at all.
Well, the industrial policy, countries cannot have an individual industrial policy in a globalised world where money can move at a keystroke from one side of the world to the other.
You've got to have a plan with other countries. You've got a lot of trouble legally actually doing these renationalisations. So you'd have to, the government may have to fight that in the court with the companies that have privatised our services.
What re-nationalisations? There aren't going to be any, Tony. We were discussing the Labour Party conference earlier. There's going to be no re-nationalisation of anything. So that's a red herring.
No, look, you can at least discuss it. But what I'm saying is that even if you wanted to re-nationalise various of these, I mean, whether we're talking about electricity, gas, water, railways, any of these things, if you wanted to renationalise them, you can't, because someone's going to take you to court and say, oh, well, you're going to have to go to court before you try and do this.
Yeah, but that's to do with the trade dispute settlements of the World Trade Organization and things like that. Ultimately, the European Union might have been a way of trying to break out of this kind of corporate control, but of course it is corporately controlled. You saw what happened in Greece, and Britain is, by being outside the European Union, gets no more or less power. We're basically, everybody is told what to do by the Wall Street and the City of London, and that's what happens.
Well,
that's it.
Thank you. We're joined in the studio by Pastor Dia Moodley. Hi, Dia, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Now, why is a pastor on a politics show?
Well,
I mean, you should ask me. I invited you, but you know, can you just explain why politics come knocking on your door, Dia?
Well, politics has come knocking on our door in the sense that the local constabulary have decided that they're going to take me to task over the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion. And they've decided that they are now suddenly experts at theology and biblical hermeneutics. And
What are nautics?
Hermeneutics, biblical hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is a word that describes the interpretation of scripture. And so the local constabulary have taken it on themselves to decide that my version of Christianity is not acceptable in the public square.
So it's your interpretation of Christianity.
So you have the local constabulary challenging my biblical interpretation of the Bible.
Well, that's very strange. Now, have they done that formally, informally?
They've done it formally, yes. So what they've done is they've served me a warning notice. But so just to give the context here, Tony, my preaching involves a dialogue. It involves debate in the public square. I invite people to come along and ask a question. I hold up a sign that says, ask me any question.
This is in city centre here in Bristol, in Broadmead.
In Broadmead. This is the way we do it. The crowd grows from one person to 200 in minutes. And so when the crowd gets out of control, the police take the course of least resistance. So rather than challenging the crowd about their blasphemy or what they're swearing or the threats of violence, they decide to silence the preacher, who's one man. So rather than go against 100 people, they go against one man. So they've taken the path of least resistance by coming out against
people. Well, to be fair to the police, they're just looking at a way to make sure that, that this conflict on the streets doesn't happen.
Well, there is no... Well, if they were keeping the law, they'd make sure, because, like, for example, Tony, when I sat with the police in Bridewell, a chief inspector said to me, he said, "Dear, listen, there's a community that sits opposite me at this table who says they're very unhappy with you challenging their view, for example, of Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism or the LGBTQ. And I said to them, "Well, listen, I respect their community, but don't you also agree there's another community called the Christian community that has a biblical worldview that equally needs to be, you know, protected?" So I say that when you wear in the constabulary uniform, you're representing the government, you're representing the law. Your view of whatever I'm saying or not saying should not come into play. It's whether I'm breaking the law or not. So if I break the law, arrest me. If I'm not breaking the law, then you need to protect
me. So have they arrested you?
No, they haven't arrested me because there's nothing I've done to cause them to arrest me.
So how come you're sitting in one of these police stations chatting with them?
That's because I took the step to do what no other street preacher or pastor has ever done in the history of the United Kingdom. I stepped into the constabulary to tell them what we're doing, how we're going about it, to prevent this sort of thing happening. And that's one of the reasons I've not been arrested, is because I went in and I worked with the chief inspector for 3 years. And he said to me, "What are you doing? This is not acceptable." And he eventually wrote me 3 letters of apologies because their inspectors were actually breaking the law by stopping us preaching. They were seizing our signboards and trampling it underfoot, telling us all sorts of things that we're not supposed to be saying, apparently, that is offensive to people.
Okay, so give us an idea of the sorts of incidents, the sort of things that you were saying, and the sort of reaction you were getting from some elements in the crowd.
Okay, so the warning notice, maybe that's a good way to start. The warning notice that they issued me in 2021 said this, right? One of the points is this: "Dear Moodley is not allowed to speak to an evolutionist or an atheist." How on earth do you come up with that? Since when have evolutionists and atheists become a group to be protected by law?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. So why are they saying that?
Well, they're saying that because part of my preaching involves, like I said, a debate. So I'm debating an evolutionist. So an evolutionist walks up to me and says, "You guys believe in a fairy tale. There is no God. Creation does not exist. There's millions of years of science and evolution, blah, blah, blah." And I say to them, "Well, okay, good. I'm going to hear your story. Tell me how you went from bacteria to Beyonce over eons of time."
Well, let me just stop you there for a second, because if you go back into time, not that long ago, actually, they would be the one who would potentially be arrested, or in fact, maybe even something worse would happen to them for having those views.
Yes. Yeah. Listen, this idea that you can't challenge somebody in the public square is ludicrous. So this idea that I'm challenging them to explain their position, and so they could step up and ask me a question, I will answer it very easily, and I welcome them to ask me a question. I welcome them to challenge me, as long as I can challenge them back. And the same with Islam. So the Muslim steps up to me and says, "Jesus Christ is not real. He's not God. He's merely a Rasul. He's merely a prophet." I say, "Okay, great. Let's go back and look at the history of Islam and how Islam came about." And then they don't like it, and that's how they complain to the police. Then you're accused of Islamophobia and all sorts of other things.
Well, it seems to me what often happens is that when people lose an argument, they almost like they go crying for money.
Of course. And so the police are very eager to take their complaints because, like I said earlier on, they actually want to not have these crowds gathering in Broadmead. They don't want to have people listen to this. They don't want to be taking complaints from people who says that I'm deeply offensive to them. So what do? They ask people to then take the complaints a little further, and that's what they've done over a period of 6 to 9
so
months.
So are you saying that the police are actually almost kind of grooming people to make complaints?
We have evidence between myself and the constabulary where they've accepted by email correspondence that officers had literally gone out to people and said, "We would like you to go complain about this man. He's offensive." They've used the word offensive. "He's offensive. Complain about him." And so this will be played out in a court case in November.
Oh, wow. Fascinating. Well, I remember, I think it was about 2 years ago we spoke to you. Maybe it was about the pandemic, I'm not sure. But anyway, at the time you said that the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees had passed you whilst you were doing your preaching in Bristol City Centre and said, well, we don't want your sort of Christianity here in Bristol.
That's exactly what he said to me, because I asked him a few questions on the day. I was very respectful of him, and I tried to reach him even afterwards by email. He refused to accept my calls. He refused to accept my emails. I had to push a little further, trying, you know, listen, Christians believe in reconciliation. You know, in finding the common ground, in finding peace. So I wanted to find peace with Marvin Rees and say, we're in the same city, let's work together. He refused to work with me. He said that I have an Americanized version of Christianity, I have a Trump version of Christianity, and really what we were doing was opening up a Bible and saying, this is what the Bible says. And he refused to accept that. He refused to talk to me, he just merely walked away.
Well, isn't it fascinating? I think sometimes people want the Bible to say what they would like it to say, and they like to. I mean, the thing is, I mean, you know, maybe you could be accused of the same thing, saying, well, you're skirting over certain passages in the Bible and focusing on ones that you want to be true.
And that's exactly why we love the debate in the public square. There's not, Tony, there are certain questions that I've been asked that really stumped me in the public square. I've had to go back and look at the scriptures again and say, well, what do I say about this? And so it's good for me. I welcome it. I welcome people challenging me intellectually, spiritually. I welcome a good debate and an argument. And that should be, that should not be stifled in the public square. Come on. You know, great thinkers and philosophers and ideologies and education came about by debate and reasoning and discussion.
Well, that's right. People like John Wesley and the Methodist Church was very strong here in Bristol, particularly amongst the miners, flocking to see his interpretation of the Bible, which was very much against the Church of England. And
actually, talk about the Church of England. So the constabulary has recruited the Church of England to form a judgment of me. So they sent the Church of England my sermons. They sent the Church of England video recordings of me. And the Church of England has compiled a 3-page dossier on me saying that nobody should believe Pastor D.A. Mowgli and his congregation, because his idea of hell, sin, and judgment is not real, but layers and layers of historical interpretation.
Well, now, you join then a whole generation for hundreds of years of dissenters and nonconformists.
Of course.
I mean, we've got loads of, you know, the Baptists, the Methodists, the Quakers, which I'm one of. I mean, there's a whole load of these nonconformists that rejected this official Church of England view of what, how to interpret the Bible. So what's the situation now? You're being told, what exactly is in this notice? What does it tell you to do?
So this notice was issued to me when I went into one of my regular meetings with the police. I'd go in every month to see how everyone's doing, to work on our relationship together. And at that meeting, I was issued a notice, and a detective who was investigating me for 9 months, I didn't even know they were investigating
me. Well, maybe this is one of the reasons we've got so much knife crime out there, that you've got some detective, like, for a best part of a year.
Investigating offence.
Investigating what someone has said about the Bible on Bristol streets. Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, so I was served this notice, and parts of these points said, for example, I'm not allowed to speak to an evolutionist or an atheist. I'm not allowed to compare Christianity to any other religion in the public square. In other words, comparative religious studies must not be done in the public square. I have to get their permission if I want to preach. I've got to preach only for an hour. I'm not allowed to bring anybody else into Bristol to preach in my place. I'm not allowed to play a recording of my sermons in the public square. And lastly, I'm not allowed to use any language that is derogatory against the LGBTQ plus.
So, for example, you're not allowed to actually read out verses of the Bible. I mean, there is a verse that says that a woman should not be allowed to preach. Now, that could be seen as offensive to any woman in your audience.
Of course. And I've had people that walked up to me and said to me, my mum's a vicar. And I would say to them very kindly, I would disagree with you, and not just me disagreeing with you, the Bible would disagree. And they would end up swearing me and saying, well, you know, this
normally it's the people that start shouting and screaming that realize that they've lost the argument. Anyway, let's just bring Martin Summers in here. Martin, you know, I know you were involved in this whole Speaker's Corner business in Bristol a few years ago, where there was an active encouragement on College Green just outside City Hall to have these sorts of debates, mainly political debates, given, but out in public. And it is, of course, an important tradition of free speech.
Well, interestingly, Speaker's Corner in London, I went to speak there during the first Gulf War in 1991. So I spoke there every day against the war. And I got big crowds, and the police came up to me at one stage and said, you do realise that the bylaws of the park say that you can only speak here on Sunday afternoons after midday and only on religious subjects. Mm. And I said, well, you better arrest me then. Mm. And they walked away. Mm. So in actual fact, that these public squares And don't forget the Speaker's Corner in London was the place where they used to go to watch the executions. So the creation of a space where people speak, people think that it's a freedom of speech route, but the actual bylaws of the park don't allow freedom of speech, although in practice the police do allow freedom of speech, but the law says that they can shut you down. And I think this issue of what is a public space, I can imagine in Broadmead, for example, where people are shopping and people are trying to get money in the shops, they don't want big crowds of people rowing and arguing. And of course, back in the day in Bristol, it was very common. I mean, Joe Banks, who's a regular contributor on this show, I'm going to see him later. He was talking about Ernie Bevan, who became eventually the Foreign Secretary, and he was the founder of the Transport and General Workers Union. He was a worker in Bristol, and in that era, in before the First World War, and then people used to go on a Sunday afternoon, and after they'd been to church, they would have these big political meetings, and it was part of the tradition. But of course, what's happened subsequently is the Broadmead is now for shopping.
Yeah. But interestingly, like you said, one of the things we make sure as a Christian church is we have our own internal policy. We don't shop. We don't stop trade. We're not in front of shops. We make sure that the crowd doesn't get big enough to affect others. So we try to keep the peace. So, for example, we're outside, you know, Sainsbury's. It's a long shop front windows. We're not affecting their door, their trade, and whatever. Still, nothing that we say to the police is making any difference. They know all of this. They absolutely do not want us to gather there to speak this version of Christianity. To such a point, there's a store in Broadmead that actually flies a drone into me. So and the police have got it on camera. The man's not been arrested. And if I just for a moment touch somebody with my Bible or my elbow, I'm immediately called in for assault and things like that. So this is a man from a shop in Broadmead flying a drone into me, and he's allowed to get away with that.
Well, it's obvious that he doesn't like you being there and what you're saying. So when you say you're trying to get, these people aren't necessarily accepting that, are they?
Right, yeah.
Well, what the police, it seems to me, have done is create a space for lawlessness by letting people like him get away with that.
Yes, indeed, a space for lawlessness. I mean, there were many times when the police were right there, and we said to them, please help us. This man is tearing our signboard or destroying
the system. Let's be clear, there's lots of people with mental illness roaming around out there. They look at anything like this, they kind of almost attracted to it like moths to the flame.
Of course, yeah. I mean, the police officer would be right there and we'd say, can you help us, please? And they say, no, we're not helping you. Literally say to us, we're not helping you because we don't agree with you. And so the last time we were out, which was last month, I actually said to the officer, I'm a citizen of the United Kingdom, and I'm calling you as a citizen to help me. This man is assaulting me. And the officer refused to respond. He says, I'm not coming to help you. And he was 5 meters away from me. He could hear everything that's going on. Our signboards were being ripped apart. We were threatened with violence, and yet they did not respond.
Well, they're not. It doesn't sound to me like Avon and Somerset Police are really acting as law enforcement at all. In fact, they are standing by, watching people breaking the law. We're seeing this increasingly. If you look around the country, that the police just do not respond sometimes when people are calling for their help.
Tony, it's absolutely ludicrous. The training that goes into the police officers. The time that I spent, when you asked me why did I first go into the constabulary, the time spent with them was on how to better police, how to be better trained to handle, for example, a protest in Bristol or preaching in Bristol, and they're not qualified for that. Here's the thing. In this dossier that they put together, 3 pages of the dossier is about police officers who responded to my preaching. So in other words, somebody complained, they responded to it, and the police officers have written that they're suffering post-traumatic stress disorder because of what I preached. Come on. Are these guys strong enough to come to my house to protect me from a burglar? Are they strong enough to come to my house to protect me from somebody who's going to do harm to me? If they're so terrified by somebody saying that there's biblical marriage and this is what biblical marriage is and you're going to go to hell if you don't repent of your sin, and that's causing them post-traumatic stress disorder, I mean, come on, who are these police officers?
Well, I mean, it's quite important that those words from the Bible are alive today, isn't it?
Of course.
They're not just sitting there in a book on a shelf gathering dust.
Yeah. Yeah, so when they say I'm not allowed to speak to an evolutionist, I'm not allowed to speak to an atheist, or I'm not allowed to compare Christianity to any other religion, what they're saying is that every other philosophy and religion is accepted in Bristol except your Christianity. We don't want your Christianity. And you know what they said to me? They said, okay, why don't you be like the Jehovah's Witness who stands on the corner? I said, I respect the Jehovah's Witness. And that's what they do.
Well, it is a cult, but yes, of course. They are people as well.
I said, I want to do what the Apostle Paul did. He went into the area. He debated with the Greeks and said, that's what we want to do. And I said, isn't that a good thing? Well, they seem to think otherwise.
Yeah, they do. Anyway, Martin, you don't believe in evolution, do you? So why is Deer allowed to talk to you? The police are saying no.
Well, I do believe in evolution.
Right, so you do. Sorry, but
it strikes me as very odd because, as you say, there are going to be very different views. And surely it should be the case that people should be able to have meetings about those views, and those meetings should be, you know, properly policed so that people have most people, if they're not interested in your view, they can just walk by.
Of course.
They don't have to do anything, do they?
Sure. And this is one of the things, you know, the crowds will stay there for a very long time, up until 2 hours, you know, at a time sometimes. And I often say to them, many of you have called me foolish and stupid and all sorts of names that are not worthy to be named, but yet you're standing here for 2 hours listening to me. You know, why? If I'm foolish, what does it make you? You know, if you're listening to me, it's because they're interested. There's something of what is being said that tugs at their heart.
It must have the ring of truth to it, I think. It's absolutely appalling to hear taxpayers' money and the police force being used to in an attempt to shut this down, even though they haven't actually shut it down. So where and when are you actually there? Is it a kind of random thing? You turn up every few weeks?
No.
Or where are you?
So we're in Bristol Broadmead. We change locations within the Broadmead area, sometimes even outside the Hippodrome.
On what day of the week?
On a Saturday we're out.
On the Sabbath?
the
Jewish Sabbath.
Yeah, the Christian Sabbath is not the Saturday, and we can talk about that if you want to. But we're out on the Saturday, normally for about 4 hours, and that's when all of our church comes out, and we have people from other parts of the country that join us as well, that come out on a Saturday.
So there is something going on here, isn't there? It's quite obvious to me, and I think many of our listeners will see. Well, this is... these sorts of debates are controlled nowadays. They're on television, they're on the radio, they're in the newspapers, they're in various other media. And it's almost like the conversations that you have down the pub that couldn't happen during the lockdowns. Yeah. It's now, there is an attempt to control this debate. So where is that going to go, that attempt?
Well, this is the scary part. I'm a Christian today, and somebody listening to me may not agree with my view on how the world came into existence. They may believe in evolution. I'll say, good for you that you're standing on what you believe. I respect your freedom of speech, and I want you to have the freedom of speech. If you think I'm talking absolutely rubbish, I respect that about you. But I want you also to understand, if they're going to shut me down now, they can easily shut you down for what you believe. So I'm here to protect your freedom. Tony, I'm an immigrant to this land, 25 years. And here I am fighting for freedom of speech and freedom of religion. It's something I did not want to be entangled with.
I didn't expect it.
And here I am. I'm drawn into it. I'm going to court on the 29th and 30th of November at my own cost. At my own cost. Even in Somerset Constabulary have issued me this notice. I've had to fight it at my own cost. And they said to me, this is absolutely legal. You can't contest this. And within a month, they withdrew it. Within 1 month, they withdrew it. Which means they were wrong in the first place. But I'm having to pay for this.
Well, it does seem that they're wasting a lot of their time. Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, right? Because I'd like you and Martin to discuss evolution.
That's not devil's advocate. That's satanic
influence.
You're just trying to create trouble. You're a troublemaker.
You can have a discussion without coming to blows. And I think you can.
Oh, yes.
And I'd like to prove that this notice is nonsense. Because what they're doing is they're saying, well, this is a worst-case scenario, and therefore you can't talk to anybody who doesn't agree with evolution. So let's start with you, Martin. What's your basic idea about why evolution is true?
Well, I'm not a trained scientist as such, but I've read a lot about this because it's very influential in modern philosophy. Evolution is regarded as very influential in modern philosophy, and things like Daniel Dennett, for example, he's written a book called Consciousness Explained, which shows, to my satisfaction anyway, that the forces that are at work in evolution have led to the evolution of consciousness, which is what we, you know, we're having a conscious discussion now. This, there's actually quite, it's quite tightly argued scientific argument about why this came about. And, you've got creationists who are literal creationists, and you've also got what are called, those who believe in design. Some kind of design.
Intelligent design.
Intelligent design. But I mean, the mainstream biology professor's view is that there is no such thing as intelligent design, that in actual fact, everything we see has in fact evolved from, very simple blocks.
The basic principle
in the first
is
place.
Natural selection, isn't it? The idea that if something has a mutation which makes it slightly more efficient or effective as an organism, then this is the basic principle, isn't it?
This is it, yes. And of course, it isn't derived from scripture at all, obviously. It's derived from the Enlightenment idea that by experimenting and looking at things, we can come to conclusions. And there's been a lot of. It's been very influential in lots of different... Because once you start thinking about evolution, think about artificial intelligence. This is about algorithms which evolve, yeah? Which get cleverer and cleverer by a process of evolution. So this idea of evolution has become... It's what's called... I think it was somebody called it Darwin's dangerous idea. I can't remember which philosopher wrote that. So in other words... I don't agree with some of the attitudes that you get from people like Richard Dawkins, because he seems to think that he's got to be anti-religious. It's perfectly logical that evolution could exist and there could still be a God behind it all. Now, I know that's not scriptural, but it's a logical point. I mean, God could be behind evolution. And I would say my mother is a priest in the Church of England. She's retired now. That would probably be her view. She's not against evolution, but she would say, well, God's all powerful. He can make evolution if he wants to.
Okay, so what about you, dear? Well, how would you answer that?
So, I'd begin by asking the evolutionist to explain.
No fisticuffs so far.
Yeah, this is how it plays out in the public square. I'd begin to ask the evolutionist to explain or to define what evolutionism is. A number of people or many people cannot actually define what that is in the sense of. How did man come about? They say, well, we evolved over time. Okay, what does it mean? So if we go scientifically, and if we talk science, we say, okay, here's the equation. Put the equation on the board. Show me on the board how man came into existence. So they'll have to put it in this form. Something, the complexities of the human world, came from nothing. Something, the complexities of man, came from nothing. Now, if you put that on a board, it's scientifically impossible. Because something cannot come from nothing.
Well, yes, it can, because chemicals can react with each other and eventually maybe produce amino acids.
Okay, so wonderful.
The building blocks of life.
Wonderful. Where do those chemicals come from?
Well, they're just there. They've always been there. Maybe it's a big bang.
So in order for something to bang, in order for it to explode, let's take it back to school, the fire triangle. In order for you to have a fire triangle, you need to have three elements. You take away one of the elements, it refuses to burn. It refuses to be a fire. The same with the combustion, same with the Big Bang. Where do those elements come from in order to bang? And that's where the evolutionist now starts to lose his rag if he doesn't know his stuff and say, well, you know, starts to rant and rave about things, or this is what happens in the public square. Very rarely do we get like a professor from Bristol who's sitting prepared to sit in the public square and say, okay, we've got a professor coming into our church on the end of October, Professor Stuart Burgess. He's the professor at the University of Bristol. He's designed components for the space station. He's designed a sprocket system for the Olympic bike. And ask him where, and that's only two of the things he's invented, ask him where he got his ideas from. He'll tell you from the knee joint, which he talks about from an evolutionist perspective and also from a creationist perspective. In other words, for example, this, which evolved first, the tongue or hunger, the stomach or the teeth? You know, how did man start walking? Which part of his limbs started evolving first?
Well, I can tell you, the idea is, in evolution, is that it starts off with a single-cell organism, then the whole thing gets bigger and bigger over millennia, or maybe millions of years.
So the single-cell organism, if you want to call that mitochondria, where did it come from? The fact that it's living... The fact that there's a life in it, where did that life come from? So I would challenge people right back to the beginning. And so forgetting about Darwin and Dawkins and Hawkins and the rest of them, I would say, let's go back to the beginning. How can something, that mitochondria, that living cell, come from nothing?
So, Martin, is this a debate worth having?
Well, I think what's interesting, what you're saying, is that the evolution has got to be, you've got something coming from nothing. And I think this is, scientists can't resolve this. The Big Bang, and the actual fact, science is such a creature that there are scientists who don't believe in the Big Bang anymore.
Yeah.
They've said because things can change.
Of course.
You know, you suddenly think, hang on a minute, we didn't, our perception of this was wrong. And that's what makes it different from the appeal to authority in scripture, because it can change. And there are scientists who will disagree with the Big Bang. They don't agree with it. But of course, the whole idea, something from nothing, why is anything here at all? And why is there life? And actually, we don't know. Because, of course, it's quite possible that a creator God may have created all of these things.
Yeah.
But, of course, it's still not, doesn't help you in terms of scripture. Even if, you know, because scripture is very, you know, it's 6 days to create the world and all the rest of it. If you've got a different view where evolution is something that you can put within a theological context, that, to my mind, is I've got no problem with that. Because, of course, that makes perfect sense, and in actual fact, it's an unknowable thing. Those who want to believe in a God can believe in it, and those who don't.
You can't put evolution into a biblical theology, because evolution involves a development of a single cell into an animal, into a human being.
Yeah.
And that takes away the theos of the theos into man. God created man in his image. And so, man cannot be in the image of God if he's a result of random chance and coincidence.
Well, I hear what you say, yeah. But there is definitely a school of thought that you can have all this random chance. But of course, what is chance? Yeah, it could all be determined, and it's not clear. You know, you can see once you get to this level,
sure,
it's quite possible to hold different views.
Isn't it fair to say, Martin, that in most mainstream universities, in science departments, etc., I mean, we've had several creation scientists on this program over the years. The whole idea of God and creation is rather poo-pooed. The idea is completely normal now. Evolution is pretty much accepted across most of our educational institutions.
Well, I think what we're talking about here is there is an intersection set of people who believe in evolution but who also believe in God. Now, I'm not saying that I'm one of those people, but I'd say my mother would probably fall into that category. But I think, you know, but we can debate these things, of course we can, but people are going to, at the end of the day, going to have their views about it, aren't they?
I'm trying to get to a point, which I'm not doing very well at it, but what I'm saying is, in our education system, this is quite an important, I think.
Well, it is important.
It's an important sort of thing for particularly teenage kids in secondary school, that there should be this kind of debate happen. For example, in a biology lesson.
Well, they do. I mean, I work in schools, Tony, and these things are debated, but of course there are two things. There's religious education and there is biology, and they're separate classes. And of course there's a debate between religious, I mean, some people, you know, this debate goes on. I mean, especially in primary schools, I've just seen in year six they've had all this stuff about what do we believe about evolution, and including people saying that they don't believe in or they believe in design. Yeah. They're exposed to all of these arguments. But of course, in a biology class, when you're moving up to sort of university level, senior level, and all the rest of it, you've got to accept evolution. Otherwise, you're not going to be taken in the university.
And that's where we're obviously going to disagree. And I think the first point is, when you say it's debated at schools, you have people that are the game is already slanted towards a certain side. For example, somebody that's making the case for creation is somebody that's pulling stuff off the internet. They're not qualified to make the case. There are RE teachers. Both my daughters were teachers in Bristol, and they taught RE in philosophy, and they were coming home and telling me that RE teachers are not actually prepared to teach RE, because they themselves are not convicted of something or convinced of something, and therefore pull something off the internet and go and tell the class. You have a biology teacher who studied biology, and we're not, and good for them. I'm in agreement with what biology is. I myself, before I became a minister, was a lecturer of anatomy and physiology. And when I went to when I was assigned my first cadaver, I had my own cadaver to work on. And I thought, this cadaver is going to draw me away from God. It did the opposite. where every vessel that I opened in the cadaver pointed me more towards how is it possible that this person is so wonderfully created? You know, how is it that the vessels have these valves going one way only and not the other way? How is it that there are 11 million nerve endings in that eye and exactly the same in that person's eye? How is it that that's random chance and coincidence? It's perfect. Somebody designed
it. Well, I think in a way, many people just look around them and they say, wow, there must be some sort of, maybe not in the centre of Bristol, but certainly out in the beautiful countryside somewhere, and saying, well, there, Martin, this is so beautiful. There does seem to be an element of design here. But they may be just conning themselves, saying.
Well, I think that, we've got to distinguish between what you might call biblical fundamentalism, the idea of intelligent design, and what you might call the mainstream of evolutionist view in biology. So they're three separate strands. I think when you talk about, we don't have what used to be called religious knowledge when I was a kid in schools, because schools were Christian, and therefore, you know, we were basically learning Christianity. You still have got some schools which are...
Ours wasn't. We had RE, religious education.
Yeah, well, that's right, but it's a bit of a dog's breakfast about who's in control of
they
schools
had a quiet,
in this country.
They didn't have any sort of chapel or anything. They had a quiet room. Yeah, but I mean, the idea was that this is a secular thing just as much as it is any other religion.
Yeah, there. I mean, different schools have different, it's become a bit of a dog's breakfast, as I say, in this country about who runs schools. But in mainstream schools, religious education is about all different kinds of religion. I think it is important that children learn about religious beliefs. They should. They should learn about their own parents' religious beliefs and their own and everybody else's as well. Yeah. It's an important part of being human to know what other people believe.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean the ideal situation would be that you'd have schools and teachers giving equal opportunity for both sides of the argument. But when a school and a particular teacher is slanted towards one way and almost laughs and scoffs at the opposite idea, that's not education. But that's what's happening at university level right now, where universities are supposed to be the place where you come to that place in life, you look out over the panoramic view, you have all of these philosophies that you're looking at, your lecturers are challenging you in so many ways to be intellectual and to think and to have these philosophies. But what's happening is every university you go to now, they actually have one particular way of looking at things. If I went to Bristol University and said, I want to come today and talk about my Christian views, I'd be shut down.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be shut. I mean, you shouldn't be shut down. Yeah. But
if I was invited, I'm saying, yes. If I was invited, let's say the Christian Union invited.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, we know there's tensions around whether people are being invited or not. But in the biology department itself, there are intelligent design people in the academic structure.
Yeah,
they do exist, but they're a minority.
Yeah.
And of course, it's a legitimate view, but of course, it's not the majority view of biologists as we speak.
Anyway, one of the people who's influenced me quite a lot in terms of my beliefs when it comes to evolution is a guy called James Perloff over in the United States. He had an extremely popular millions of views on his video about evolution and creation, which was then taken down off of YouTube and then it popped up somewhere else. And I think the title of the video is God is Real, Here's the Proof, something like that. Anyway, James, we're going to hear from now, because here he does a little discussion, a monologue about the debate between evolution and creation. Here's an extract from that now.
Billions of years ago, when the right chemicals formed our single-celled ancestors by chance. And then these single-celled creatures began to evolve into multicellular creatures, and they became the first seagoing invertebrates, a creature without a backbone like a jellyfish. Then the invertebrates evolved into fish, and then fish yearned to come ashore, and so their fins started to evolve into legs, and they became the first amphibians, which are creatures, of course, that can go on land or water like a frog. And then amphibians evolved into reptiles, reptiles evolved into mammals, and then eventually within the class of mammals, you had these ape-like creatures who evolved into man. And that's a theory in a nutshell. It might be taught a little differently from one school of thought to another, but that's it. And that's basically what your kids are taught in school. So to start at the beginning, the origin of life, and Darwin did talk about that, the origin of species, said that life began in a warm little pond, but after a while they realized that a pond wouldn't last long enough for significant evolution to take place, so they changed it to the ocean. So let's see what's wrong with this. Now, I've got a can here of all-natural cola, and if we look at it, it says cola. It says 12 ounces, which it reminds us, in this case, is 354 mLs. It says Whole Foods on it, And it's got a list of ingredients, the amount of fat and sodium, and it's got a barcode, which is scannable, and it's got a pop top, which works very nicely, and it's got cola inside, very tasty, right? Now, does anybody think that this can and its contents and the printing on the outside could have originated by pure chance? And obviously not. I mean, it's too well designed. So that raises the question of how could a cell come about by chance, because it's astronomically more complex than the can I just showed you. And I want to give you a quote. The quote is this, quote, "A simple one-cell bacterium, or a coli, contains DNA information units that are the equivalent of 100 million pages of Encyclopedia Britannica," unquote. And that quote is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, cells have a functional unit called proteins. That's their basic unit. And even in a bacterial cell, there's thousands of different proteins. And not to get technical, but proteins are found down in a smaller building block called amino acids, and there's hundreds in one protein, and they have to be in the right order. And some of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard of Francis Crick. He won the Nobel Prize for co-discovering the structure of DNA. And he calculated what the odds would be of getting a protein by chance, you know, NaH in ocean. You know what the odds are, according to Francis Crick? The odds are 1 in 10 to the power of 260. And if you want to know how big a number that is, you couldn't fit that many electrons in the known universe. Mathematicians really say that anything with odds greater than 1 in 10 to the power of 50 is impossible. So it would be impossible to get one protein by chance, let alone the thousands a cell would need. And think about it. A cell would need the ability to ingest nutrients, expel waste. And really think about this one. This first cell formed by chance before it died in the span of one lifetime would have had to develop and perfect the process of cellular reproduction, because if it didn't, there never would have been a second cell, and Darwin's evolutionary process would stop right there.
So Darwin's process would stop right there, Martin. So how do you answer that one?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting debate, because of course it all presumes that that the actual account of evolution is correct, but it's saying that it's so complicated, an individual cell is so complicated that it must have been created by God. But that's not the creation of the Earth in 6 days, is it?
Well, what James Perloff is describing there is nothing to do with the Bible at all.
Well, he's actually looking at it from a very, very scientific point of view. And so when we draw science into it, we have to, and that's why we said we can't put the equation on the board. And Hawkings and Dawkins would agree with that. And that's why they're moving away from the idea. They don't want people to talk about the fact that something came from nothing. They kind of actually have said that the creationist is right to say that something cannot come from nothing. So where did it come from? So the creationists would say, well, the answer to the question is it came from God. And actually the first few lines of the Bible is scientific. It says this, the Genesis chapter 1 says this, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And any scientist worth his salt will say, let's talk about time, space, and matter. Time, space, and matter have to be in existence at the same time. They cannot evolve. You cannot have time evolving first and space evolving first and then matter evolving first. For example, if you had matter and no space, where would you put the matter? If you had space and matter without time, when would you put it? So they all have to be together at the same time. And so how do we explain that? Well, the Bible explains that. The Bible says, in the beginning, time, God created the heavens, space, and the earth, matter. So they all created this at the same time. That perfectly fits into the scientific worldview that time, space, and matter have to exist at the same time. And so in Adam, in the garden, in the earth, was an already existing, well, when God created it, he created it like it's millions of years old. He created it like it's already been functioning, fully functioning for millions of years old. Is it impossible for God to do that? No. He's God. That's the very definition of him, that he can do it. And so the question then comes to ask is, why does man reject that? Why would man reject that? Well, there's various answers to that question.
Why?
Well, because, you know, very often people say that Christianity is the crutch that people lean on. Others say that, I think it was Lennox, the Northern Ireland theologian, who said that evolutionists and atheists are afraid of the light and therefore live in the dark, the light being the science that actually comes from the scriptures. In fact, astronomers, early astronomers were basing their views on the universe from the Bible. The Bible talks about the earth as a sphere, as a ball. The Bible talks about it hanging in space. The book of Job in Psalms, it also, you know, says so. I think the worth and the value of man didn't come about from an evolutionary process. The worth and the value of man, the reason why you respect me and I respect you, and the reason why we want peace, and the reason why we have empathy and love and we can share this with one another, is because of the moral value that God put into man, rather than how it came about through an evolutionary process.
So, Martin, that one thing's for sure, over the centuries, people have been believing in God less and less, haven't they? Particularly here in the Western world, here in the UK. I mean, if you get to go back 300-400 years, almost everybody did, and maybe they did because they were told that they had to believe in God.
Well, I mean, the human society has obviously, you know, it keeps changing and transforming. I mean, it's quite clear that there were, you know, in historical terms, hardly anybody didn't believe in God. There was nobody who didn't believe in it, or a God. But of course, once you say a God, you start to open. You know, well, what is this God that we all? Because then people disagree about that. I think this is an interesting discussion, because I think by having to debate with these scientific ideas, it refines your own views.
Yes.
Because I think there's a lot of potential common ground here, if you can accept that if God is as great as you say, all of these things could be true. The evolutionist perspective could be true, but the fundamental question: why is there anything at all instead of nothing? Nobody really knows how to answer that, do they? And I can't see that any possible experiment you could carry out would give you an answer.
Well, look, let's wind this up with both of you saying why you think, and maybe you first, Martin, that this debate that's taking place with Dia on a Saturday afternoon down in Broadmead is important, and an important debate to protect.
Well, I think freedom of speech is important to protect, and obviously I support your right to freedom of speech. I think one part of the problem is that people are actually quite belligerent about their views, and they're not necessarily as sophisticated in putting them forward as we're doing here. Because this is an informal discussion in a controlled way. But when you're in the middle of the streets, you're going to have some people coming up to say, you know, they don't really want to have a discussion. They want to have an argument, and that's partly to do with the, you know, people just being belligerent and silly.
It's a debate which is not happening elsewhere, isn't it? So this is surely what the street's for.
We're not creating platforms for these debates. I mean, one of the reasons I will not, many times, I've asked the question, do I need to go back? Why do I need to get beaten up? Why do I have to have, you know, depending on the weather, if it's summertime, I get slushies and milkshakes thrown at me. Now winter, I'll get coffees thrown at me. Why do I need to do this? Why do I need to get beaten up? And I'll tell you, Tony, listen, the number of people that have come to me afterwards, when all the crowds have disappeared, and said, thank you so much, I didn't realize that what you just said. Or, for example, when does life begin? On the abortion issue, or slavery in the Bible, or on this political issue that you brought from a Christian worldview. And they would wait for the... Well, that's another problem anyway. Why would they wait for the crowd to disappear? Because they're too scared in the middle of the crowd to say, I actually agree with you. Oh, tell me some more. Because if they do that, the crowd's going to jump on them. And so they wait until the end. And I have now realized, I preach from 12:30 to 4:30. I'm now there till 6:00. Knowing that people are going to hang around to talk with me. And they say, thank you so much for that. I've had University of Bristol students who are doing masters in genetics say to me, we're going to prove you wrong today. At the end of it, come and shake my hand and say, you've changed my mind. And so I'm going to continue to do that.
Well, isn't it interesting? So whereabouts is your church, and how do people find you?
We're in Lockleys on Romney Avenue. Romney Avenue. The church is called Spirit of Life Reformed Baptist Church. We are a Reformed church, meaning it goes back to the Reformation, Martin Luther, John Calvin. We hold to a Reformed doctrine. We're very conservative in our biblical views and our biblical practice. And so we wouldn't have a woman minister, we wouldn't have women elders, a woman lead the church. And we've been called into question for that. And we just bought this property in Lockleys. And we went onto the Lockleys homepage and said to them, hey, we're the new church here. And they said to us, fabulous. We thought the property is going to be sold to some flats and, you know, developers. Thank you so much that you bought the building. Welcome to the community. Somebody decided to Google us and went into our doctrinal statement and saw in our doctrinal statement that we believe that it is men who lead the church. They turned the entire community against us and now want us out of the community. They said, you no longer belong in this community with your views.
Well, I mean, I would have thought that there were people, you know, that's they're trying to represent a specific part of the community, which they don't necessarily represent. Yeah. They more represent themselves, which is what we're finding so much in journalism and politics as well. Anyway, I hope you can stay with us for a little while because we're going to be discussing the Holy Land after after the break.
The first lesson is written in the 14th chapter of the prophet Hosea, beginning to read at the first verse, in which the prophet speaks words of blessing and hope. Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take words with you and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all guilt, accept that which is good, and we will offer the fruit of our lips. Assyria shall not save us. We will not ride upon horses. We will say no more, our God, to the work of our hands. In you the orphan finds mercy. I will heal their disloyalty. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned from them. I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall blossom like the lily. He shall strike root like the forests of Lebanon. His shoots shall spread out. His beauty shall be like the olive tree, and his fragrance like that of Lebanon. They shall again live beneath my shadow. They shall flourish as a garden. They shall blossom like the vine. Their fragrance shall be like the wine of Lebanon. O Ephraim, What have I to do with idols? It is I who answer and look after you. I am like an evergreen cypress. Your faithfulness comes from me. Those who are wise understand these things. Those who are discerning know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the upright walk in them. But transgressors stumble in them. Tonight's reading from the Old Testament.
Give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. And listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western sky. On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise.
I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences, and gaze at the moon till I lose my senses. And I can't look at hovels, and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze, and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western skies.
On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise.
Ba 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 ba.
I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences, and gaze at the moon till I lose my senses. And I can't look at hobbles, and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in, no.
Papa, don't you fence me in.
Let us pray. Let us thank God for all his goodness, and pray that we might be better stewards of the wonderful creation he has entrusted to us. O God, the only source of life and energy and wealth, defend our planet Earth. Teach us to conserve and not to squander the riches of nature, to use aright the heritage of former generations, and to plan for the welfare of our children's children. Renew our wonder, awaken our concern, and make us better stewards and more careful tenants of the world you lend us as our home. Hear us, O Lord, our Creator and Redeemer, for the sake of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
Let us pray for the peace of the world, for Charles our King, his government and parliaments, and for all the leaders of the nations. Especially on our hearts today is the conflict in the lands of our Lord's earthly life. Heavenly Father, be with us in our search for peace in ourselves and in this world you have made. Diminish pride and increase humility. Weaken suspicion and nourish trust. Deepen true love and understanding in every heart, and unite us all in the bonds of fellowship as members of one family, serving you in the name of our Saviour, Jesus Christ. Amen.
So you heard there the hymn Jerusalem with the choir of Salisbury Cathedral, the Collegiate Church, some prayers from Choral Evensong, the Collegiate Church of St. Mary's in Warwick. Warwick University, of course, being Warwick Business School, where some of these Bilderbergers come from, and also the university's philosophy departments, where my school friend, Nick the Nazi, Nick Land, of the Dark Enlightenment fame, where he went. And after that, we heard from 1944, the Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters with Don't Fence Me In. And after that, from 2017, it's Blue Train, the saxophonist there, Gilad Atzmon. I had a quite fascinating little chat with this week to get his take, but he's retired now. He doesn't want to be interviewed about things like Gaza or anything like that, which is a bit of a pity. I'll see if I can persuade him another time. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Met with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also still with us for a little while is Pastor Dia Moodley and me Tony Gosling. So we've got to start, obviously, with this horrific, we're mentioned there in the Coral Evans song on Radio 3 earlier this week, this horrific attack last Saturday. We'll start with you, though, Martin. I mean, put it in context, this is being portrayed as almost coming out of the blue, but, of course, that's really not the case. Do you think it was justified what Hamas did on Saturday?
I think that if they'd stuck to military targets, it would have been extremely effective. But because of, you know, I'm afraid people do fall. I mean, they from my point of view, they should have stuck to military targets. From their own point of view, they are very angry and bitter, and they feel that people in Israel haven't understood that they think that you know, because there's been loads and loads of civilians killed in Gaza by the Israelis. Far more than has been killed by the other side. This is the first time that they've actually managed to fight back in such a way as to cause real hurt to the other side. And don't forget that all of these villages around Gaza, the people inside Gaza used to live in those villages and were driven out of those villages by the people who are now in them.
Well, I noticed Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, he intervened saying he found the whole thing horrific. And if a conflict like this has to develop, he was really condemning the men for killing women and children. He said, look, if the men fall out, they should not be including the women and children from either side.
I think it's pretty clear that even those who are very much opposed to the state of Israel, nobody is saying that it's okay for what they did. I think everybody's pretty clear that it's made it complicated to explain to the middle of the road people. I understand why they're as angry as they are, but a lot of people won't understand it. But of course, you can't tell the oppressed to you know, it's easy for me to say, sitting in my armchair hundreds of miles away. A lot of these young lads that are fighting in Hamas have had loads of their family killed. They're bitter. And of course, in World War II, for example, we incinerated thousands and thousands of German civilians, and nobody got punished for that. The creation of the State of Israel in the first place in the 1940s, the terrorist actions of the Irgun and the Haganah killed thousands and thousands of people, and they didn't get punished. They became the leaders of the new state, and Hamas are basically giving the Israeli state exact that they learned how to do this from the Israelis. The Israelis show them, if you're ruthless enough and you're very determined, you won't lose. You can perhaps, it's the only way to win. And that's how we won our state in the first place, by blowing up the King David Hotel, by massacres at Deir Yassin and so on, by the displacement of people. That's how the state was created.
I mean, it is very much a British responsibility. Anyway, thanks for staying with us for a few minutes, dear. Be interesting to hear. I know you're going to be preaching on Sunday about this.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking to my church about this, and there's a lot of talk within the church about what does it mean to pray for Israel. Let me just say right now, my position theologically, biblically, is there is a secular state called Israel. It is not the Israel of the Bible. You know, the Israel, the secular state, is actually anti-biblical. You can't go to Jerusalem and preach Christ without having somebody say, I'm going to stab you with a knife or a screwdriver. So they literally throw you out of Jerusalem. Having said that, looked at the news, we're joined with everyone that says we mourn this life taken on both sides, but especially on the absolute slaughter of children, the beheading of children, if that has truly happened, the beheading of children, and it's absolutely horrible. But when I look at this, and I'm agreeing with what you're saying in a sense, for me, when I look at this, it wasn't just a military strategy. This is like a religious war, because part of their charter, if you read it, and if I understand it correctly, is to annihilate the Jews, is to annihilate the infidel. You know, all those who disagree with them. And so even when the video footage was shown of the Hamas man taking the lady by the hair and shoving her into a car, what are they all screaming? They were screaming, Allahu Akbar, praise be to their God. Oh, their God is the highest. I'm imagining that was the shouts that came out of them even as they were beheading these children. This is not a war to gain ground or to seize a piece of land or to annex a particular place. This was to make a statement that your life is what we're coming after. What I'm going to be talking about is encouraging my church on how to pray about this. And if you want to know about that, I can talk about that, because I don't want to pray for Israel only, or I'm not praying for a state. I'm praying for the people of Israel, but also equally praying for the people of Palestine. I'm praying for Hamas, like I would pray for those who in Africa are seizing the children every time and taking them away into the strongholds of their armies and raping them and causing them to give birth and whatever the case may be. We're praying for them also. This is the evil of man's heart on both sides. And so when I say pray for the peace of Jerusalem, listen, every United States president wants world peace. Every person who's crowned Miss Universe wants world peace. That's what they say. What are you going to do for 1 year? World peace. There is no peace with man unless there's peace with God. And the Bible says there is a Prince of Peace. He's called Jesus Christ. And unless there's peace with God, then there's peace with man.
It's bizarre that up until the creation of the Israeli state, actually, there was relative peace in that part of the world. Christians, Muslims, Jews all lived happily together.
So we will say, relative peace. And we were talking about this the other day as well. I was in the gym and I was talking to a lady from Russia, and we were talking about the things happening in the Ukraine. And she's talking about how in communities they used to live together in harmony. And I asked her, was it because you were really compromising? Because if you live next door to somebody and you truly disagree with what they're saying and it convicts you that you believe in A and they believe in B, and how do you live together? Are you then neglecting what you truly believe by compromising, and therefore you're living together in those communities? Because if you really stood by what you believe, there would be conflict. And the Bible tells us so, tells me that there will be conflict. You know, Paul making it very clear, Jesus even making it clear, you go out in the world and tell people about you, they're going to hate you because they first hated me. And so there is going to be this conflict that comes between people when you disagree.
Almost inevitable. Anyway, thanks very much, dear, for hanging around with us. Spirit of Life Church. Have you got a website? I suppose you must have.
spiritoflife.org.uk.
So thank you very much for joining us. We're going to hear now from Gabor Mate, who's Jewish himself. He was on a show. He lives actually over, I think, in New York or in the United States somewhere, where he's talking here about the whole situation over there and how we came to this as a Jew.
I barely survived. My grandparents were killed in Auschwitz. And most of my extended family was killed. I became a Zionist. This dream of the Jewish people resurrected in their historical homeland, and the barbed wire of Auschwitz being replaced by the boundaries of a Jewish state with a powerful army. And then I found out that it wasn't exactly like that. That in order to make this Jewish dream a reality, we had to visit a nightmare on the local population. And there's no way you could have ever created a Jewish state without oppressing and expelling the local population. Jewish Israeli historians have shown without a doubt that the expulsion of the Palestinians was persistent, it was pervasive, it was cruel, it was murderous, and with deliberate attempt. So that's what's called the Nakba in Arabic, the disaster or the catastrophe. There's a law that you cannot deny the Holocaust. But in Israel, you're not allowed to mention the Nakba, even though it was at the very basis of the foundation of the state. I visited the occupied territories, Russell, during the first Intifada. I cried every day for 2 weeks at what I saw. The brutality of the occupation, the petty harassment, the murderousness of it, or cutting down of Palestinian olive groves, the denial of water rights, the humiliations. And this went on, and it's much worse now than it was then. It's the longest ethnic cleansing operation in the 20th and 21st centuries. I could land in Tel Aviv tomorrow and demand citizenship under the right law of the right of return. But my Palestinian friend in Vancouver, Hannah Kawas, who was born in Jerusalem, can't even visit. Now, if I have the right of return after 2,000 years, how come Hannah hasn't got the right to return after 70 years? So then you have these miserable people packed into this horrible, people call it the world's largest outdoor prison, which is what it is. You don't have to support Hamas policies to stand up for Palestinian rights. That's a complete falsity. You take the worst thing you can say about Hamas, multiply it by 1,000 times, and it still will not meet the Israeli repression and killing and dispossession of Palestinians. Anybody who criticizes Israel is an anti-Semite is simply an egregious attempt to intimidate good non-Jews who are willing to stand up for what is true.
That I think is, you know, for me, absolutely fascinating. Gabor Maté there, over in the States, who's himself a Holocaust survivor, giving us a bit of a history lesson, the sort of history lesson we're not getting on the mass media.
Well, obviously, there are people like him who've got a very clear-eyed view of what's been going on. But sadly, they are silenced by much louder voices.
So what do you make of the, again, I come back to this justification for this attack on Saturday, because, you know, you can see how what's slowly been going on in Gaza and the West Bank, is the spirit of the Palestinian people is being broken.
Well, if you think about it, not that long ago, they had the Great March of Return, where they non-violently moved towards the border and were all shot down in their hundreds, and many people maimed for life. And at a certain point, you can see that what Hamas have done here, all over the oppressed parts of the Middle East, because many people live in very miserable conditions, as you know, under quite oppressive regimes, they have demonstrated that we are not going to be, you know, we're not going to go quietly here. It's a reckless policy. But of course, what they're really playing for is to escalate the war. And of course, this is exactly where we are. The British government has basically said we're on the side of Israel and sent our naval ships to support them. But they're going to carry out a huge massacre here. And when they carry out that huge massacre, Hezbollah in Lebanon have already said, if they start doing that, we are going to join in. Then, of course, the Israelis will attack Hezbollah, and they will also try. Lindsey Graham in the United States is saying, well, we've got to go to war with Iran here, because Iran's behind all of this. And before you know it, we're going to have World War III. And, of course, that is the strategy of Hamas here. Their strategy is, we're not going to suffer in silence. We're going to pull the whole thing down on top of everybody because you've ignored our views for so long.
Well, I mean, certainly one of the main tactics seems to be the taking of hostages to force negotiation. But, of course, the Israelis are saying, no, we're not going to negotiate with you. We're going to keep killing you until you give the hostages back.
It's interestingly, Haaretz, which is, like the Israeli version of the Guardian, said, well, we've got to negotiate with them. Whereas Smotrich and the other far right people in the administration are saying, well, we don't care about the hostages because we're going to use this as an opportunity to wipe them out. Now, there's been discussion about whether the Rafah crossing should be opened, because if the Rafah crossing was opened, these people could flee to Egypt. But the Egyptians have closed the crossing, and the Israelis have also bombed the crossing to prevent any supplies coming into Gaza. And Netanyahu has said that they should all leave Gaza, but they won't let them out.
Well, I think what they're trying to do, because Gaza has got about 2 million people in it, in the south, they're saying that the Palestinians have got to have to move to the north of Gaza. So the idea is to squash the Palestinians into half of the existing space that they're in, and then they're going to pound the south half of Gaza and send the military and tanks, etc., into there.
I think that they're thinking twice about that, because you can't get tanks into Gaza once it's been bombed to pieces. It's going to be the real threat is from Hamas side is things like no food, no water, no electricity.
Yeah, so the response has basically been to the gunmen attacking from Hamas on Saturday has been mainly airstrikes.
That's right, and totally indiscriminate airstrikes as well. There's been no attempt whatsoever to pinpoint what you're hitting, and the defense minister said they're not human. And somebody else says there are no innocents in Gaza, and these are all government spokespersons.
That's right, and animals they've been described of, which is very much reminiscent of this whole Nazi idea of the Untermensch.
Well, it is. Of course it is. And, this is why this has happened. Because there hasn't been any serious negotiation that there should have been years ago to resolve this.
We're at the stage where almost everybody that can actually remember the Second World War and the Nazi horrors is now passed away. And it's almost as if now that community memory has disappeared, it's time to have a go again.
Well, you could say that, but I think also what you've got is these historical antagonisms just don't go away until they're resolved. And the state, don't forget, in the 1990s, we went to war with Serbia to support the Kosovo Liberation Army, who were terrorists. They killed Serbs indiscriminately. But we went to war to protect them because they were apparently on our side. Where's the no-fly zone over Gaza? That's what we did in Libya. We said these people are fighting each other. It's all very nasty, but we're not going to allow the government to use air power. And of course, that was just a trick so they could overthrow Gaddafi.
What about the Times of Israel reported just a few years ago a fantastic, fascinating article about how Hamas was actually a creation of Israel because they wanted to stymie Yasser Arafat and the PLO.
Which
was around behind. So they created Hamas in order to what's the dynamic going on there? Why is and how is Hamas different to the PLO? I understood it, was more of a secular organisation.
The PLO was a secular organisation which in theory, included all political factions within the Palestinian
National movement. Religious factions in Palestine.
Yes. Hamas was originally encouraged by the Israelis as a means of undermining the PLO.
Now, Yasser Arafat, by the way, was poisoned with polonium by the Israelis, killed by them.
That's right. So you could say that Hamas is, the Frankenstein's monster created by Mossad. But it's also true that Hamas has developed its own historical, the IRA was heavily infiltrated by the British Army and the British Intelligence Service. It didn't mean that they were entirely controlled by them. And the same is true of Hamas today.
The key point here is that whilst there was a secular resistance to the Israeli occupation, which included all the different factions, we've now got one which isn't quite like that. So it sort of exacerbates this whole Jewish-Muslim conflict, as a conflict like that.
It does, but I think Hamas, in fact, are actually, but because of, some historical circumstances, they are, in fact, what they're playing for is negotiations.
What about the use of this term terrorism? Because
The terrorists are just the people that you don't like. That's what it boils down to. I mean, is it terrorism for the Israeli Air Force to bomb hundreds of children to death, as they've done in the last week? It's not terrorism, because that's a state actor. As the Irish joke goes, how do you know which ones are the terrorists? They're the ones with the little bombs.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the Murdoch Empire trying to sort of browbeat and bully the BBC into, you must call the Hamas fighters terrorists, because, of course, this is a term which is actually a major part of Netanyahu's policy for the last 40, back to the 1970s even. He wanted to create this whole idea of terrorists out there. In fact, he wrote a book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win. He's built a career on this idea of fighting terrorism.
Yes, and if you go back to the 1940s, who pioneered these techniques of ruthless terror? It was the Irgun and the Haganah who were fighting the British Army while the British Army was fighting Rommel in the Western Desert. They were trying to kill British soldiers in Palestine.
Didn't they invent the letter bomb and the car bomb?
They did indeed. And of course, they also had the view that you can be absolutely ruthless in terms of killing civilians, and at the end of it, they will shake your hand and say, okay, you can have a state. None of the people who were behind the terrorism in the 1940s were ever punished by anybody. They became the founding fathers of the Israeli state, and that's exactly how Hamas see themselves today. We're going to do exactly the same as you did all those years ago, and at the end of it all, they will shake our hands and say we're going to be the state of Palestine.
We were actually
that is their strategy.
Discussing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the last few weeks and over the last few months, because there have been street demonstrations, because he's trying to get the constitution changed, because he's being prosecuted for fraud and he could end up in prison, and he wants to make sure the constitution is changed so that he doesn't. And these have been enormous demonstrations on the streets every weekend since the beginning of 2023, and yet he is in charge of this. He's supposedly going to lead the fight against Hamas, although there's serious doubts over whether he should even be out of jail himself.
Well, I understand that the national unity government that they were going to form in Israel has collapsed. So they've not been able to pull the more liberal Zionists and the more extreme Zionists into a national government. Also, there is various, straws in the wind that the Israelis had foreknowledge of this attack, and it's, and some people are saying that Netanyahu knew the attack was coming, didn't do anything to stop it, because he knows he can save his political career by riding to the rescue of the country and, you know, starting a war with Iran, because that's definitely on the cards. People are talking like, we're going to have to go for a war with Iran. Fools in the United States like Lindsey Graham, for example. And, of course, the aircraft carriers moving into the eastern Mediterranean. Don't forget the Russian army is based in Syria. And the Russians ultimately, I mean, Hamas have forced the issue here for their allies around the world, saying, look, we're not just standing back here. And the Russians probably do not want to fight with the Israelis or the British or the Americans in the eastern Mediterranean. But it may well be that that's what will happen. It's being talked about, for example, that the Russian Navy may put in a humanitarian flotilla to bring supplies, humanitarian supplies into Gaza. And if the British try and stop them, then they're going to shoot at them. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to happen. I'm just saying that's one of the things that could happen. What's happened here is the whole drift towards war, which has been going on for a very long time now, since 9/11 and so on, this is where we're starting to get there. Because the two teams are lining up. In Latin America, for example, most of the governments in Latin America have refused to condemn what's happened, in terms of, they've said we're not happy about the killing of civilians, but the real issue here is that Palestinians are fighting for their state, which they ought to have. So Gustavo Petro, who's the president of Colombia, has come straight out with it, as have Elmo and so on. Now, you'll see in the rest of the world, the rest of the world isn't automatically siding with Israel. It's the same people who lined up against Russia and Ukraine, who are lining up to support the Israelis, and everybody else, not so much. Even to the point of saying, look, the Palestinians are doing exactly what Winston Churchill said we would do if we were invaded. They're fighting on the beaches, they're fighting on the streets of their cities, they will never surrender. And they're making that very clear. Of course, lots of young people all over the Arab world can see that. Hamas have given the Israelis a bloody nose, and they're actually cheering, as they might. Because, of
well,
course,
they're not, they're running away because they're being told to get out. Anyway, look, let's have a listen now to Raggy Omar on Channel 4 News, interviewing the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert.
An emergency national unity government was announced today, led by Prime Minister Netanyahu, a man whom Ehud Olmert has been protesting against for months and who he strongly opposes.
Do you think he is the wartime leader that Israel needs at this moment?
He's the worst person to have to deal with it. He, first of all, he has no trust in a major part of the Israeli public opinion, particularly amongst those who have to carry the burden of fighting. All of the security community of the State of Israel, all the former generals and the chief of staff and defense ministers and heads of Mossad and head of the Secret Service and head of police, you name it, all of them were absolutely set out against him. He considers himself to be a Churchillian leader. There is the, if there can be an opposite for Churchill, this is Netanyahu, unfortunately.
But he warns that even when Israel defeats and destroys Hamas, the eternal question will always be there.
Palestinian issue is here. Now, what do we want? To fight all the Palestinians, to destroy all the Palestinians, to kill all of them? I don't want it. I want to kill the terrorists and I want to make peace with the others. And that's what the government has to do.
Ehud Olmert has led Israel to war in Gaza. Does he feel this will be the last one?
We'll have to live through it to know.
But you think we could be here again? This may not be the last time.
I hope it will be, at least for a long time. But I definitely can guarantee they will not meet again.
So that's Ehud Olmert, the former Israeli Prime Minister, Martin, saying, well, actually, Netanyahu needs to get out of the way because most of the military, certainly the military intelligence side, think that he's a serious problem.
Well, as I say, it's definitely being suggested that some people in the Israeli government may have known what was going to happen and let it happen. Either Netanyahu, to save his skin, or those within the military who want Netanyahu.
How would it save his skin to allow a massive massacre of Jews?
because he then rides to the rescue as the man to save the country. That's definitely the game he's playing. Whether he can get away with that or not is not clear. We shall have to see what happens. Obviously, things are, the developments are happening faster and faster. You know, while we've been on air, no doubt there could have been many, all sorts of developments which I'm unaware of because I'm not sitting in front of a computer.
So we've also had, just a side issue, I suppose you could say, the Israelis hit two main airports and crippled Syria's two main airports today.
Yeah, well, I think what Hamas are playing for is to draw Syria, Hezbollah, and ultimately Russia into the conflict.
Is that why the British are sending warships over there? Because actually it's not really about Hamas or about domestic Palestinians. It's really about the Arab world,
yeah,
this battle.
That's right. Well, Hamas are calling on all Muslims and Arabs to rise up against Western imperialist domination of the Middle East. That's what they're doing. It's like a 1916 type of hopeless uprising, but they obviously can't win on their own. But if they can turn it into a major war with everybody involved, then the possibility is at the end of World War III, states like Israel, which have only been there for 70 odd years, only created in the last World War, it could end.
Well, one of the
if you're not prepared to negotiate a two state solution on 1967 borders, well, in that case, all bets are off, and maybe the whole state is going to be liquidated. And that happens. The state in Nagorno-Karabakh has just been liquidated, and all the people have been kicked out. And they're not going back. That's what happens. It's happened to them. It can happen to the Israelis, can't it?
Well, maybe. So lots of, I suppose, frenetic negotiations going on at the moment with, isn't it Blinken is over there right now, the US Secretary of State?
I don't know exactly what's going on.
Somebody's over there.
Yeah,
anyway,
they're all. I mean, obviously, everybody's on WhatsApp. They're not talking to each other.
I suppose
a lot
of diplomatic discussions of the Israelis wanting to do X and Y, and various people saying yes or no, particularly their paymasters in the United States. But Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hecht is a spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Force, the soldiers who are apparently about to go into Gaza. So here is his description of what he thinks took place and the reasons behind it, partly anyway, last Saturday.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hecht is a spokesman for the Israeli army. I spoke to him earlier and asked what shape he expects this war to take.
So we have an unprecedented event, Kathy, that happened this morning, where Hamas basically unleashed a combined offensive on Israel with a massive salvo of rockets and also a ground incursion invasion to Israel. So this is something which is unprecedented. They came in not focusing on military targets. They moved into the communities surrounding the Gaza Strip, targeting families, grandmothers, children, a nature party that was happening near Gaza. So we are planning our response, but our first stage right now, as we speak, we're still fighting. Our first stage is to restore security in these 22 locations. And then we'll plan our future response towards Gaza. And it is going to be severe.
Well, do you expect that severe response, as you put it, to include sending troops into Gaza?
Our focus is now restoring security. There's people now in siege in these communities, families, children, grandmothers. And I can confirm that we have also had people abducted. So just again, the mindset of people coming through the fence, capturing a grandmother, taking her into the Gaza Strip, people from a party. So we have some hostages, we have some casualties, and it's been a very, very severe and hard day.
Hamas says that they've got enough Israeli captives, as they put it, to force you to free all Palestinian prisoners in your jails. I mean, is a prisoner exchange possible to liberate these hostages? Is that something you consider you have in the past?
We are not talking about that right now. That'll be talked about probably in the future. Right now, we're focusing on a real war that's going on right now in the south.
Yeah, so that is Colonel Richard Hecht, Israeli Defense Force, Martin, with his initial reaction to this. Now, in the initial flurry last Saturday, which that was part of, there was an enormous amount of, and over the first few days this week, disinformation coming out. In fact, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, an excellent Channel 4 news report pointing out that much of the things that we were being told, even on front pages of newspapers here in Britain, was just disinformation.
As the Israel-Hamas conflict intensifies, so too does a war of information, with claims and counterclaims spreading at lightning speed online. Social media has been flooded with unverified information as the quest for facts becomes a battleground in itself.
And you're saying 40 babies, dead babies?
That is what one of the commanders told me.
Take this claim, that 40 babies were murdered in one kibbutz, causing shock around the world after it was reported live on Israeli TV. Spreading like wildfire, it made its way across the internet and onto the front pages of the newspapers here. But the amount of people killed in this attack isn't yet known. And when we asked the Israeli army today, they told us women, children and toddlers had been murdered, but could not confirm any numbers. As the EU warned social media titans Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, they had 24 hours to take action against disinformation or face legal action.
Information warfare is a critical part of any war these days. And what we're seeing is a flood of disinformation produced by a variety of actors, you know, hostile states, extremists, both foreign and domestic, what we call engagement farmers, so people who use outrage to cynically gain influence and followers for themselves.
Now, it's important, isn't it, to make the distinction between deliberate disinformation and the mistaken misinformation when people just simply have got it wrong.
The end effect is the same, of course. But really, disinformation actors are far more effective and far more sort of considered in the way that they operate. Either they're producing high quality content, which is designed to generate engagement and therefore increased visibility.
A flood of fake videos and photos have filled social media since Hamas's attack on Saturday, making it almost impossible to separate fact from fiction. These images are not Israeli helicopters getting destroyed by Hamas rockets. They're all over social media, but they are in fact from a video game called Arma 3. And you might have seen this video. It's actually from eastern Ukraine from earlier this year, but it's being misrepresented as Israeli forces attacking Gaza in this conflict. As our own teams on the front line report on the horrors of this war, the appalling atrocities committed, and the murders of men, women and children. Simultaneously, social media has opened up a new frontier for propaganda, similar to what we saw at the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Generally speaking, the cleverest kind of disinformation strategists are the ones who manage to leverage not only the ability to spread content with a grain of truth, but not enough of it, let's say, and use that to kind of tap into residual or existing biases, anger, outrage, and these kinds of things. And that's the kind of space where disinformation can really thrive.
While the world rushes for information, in a space where disinformation is rife, millions are trying to make sense of the nonsensical, and that's a fact.
Lies being told about babies in incubators, if you remember.
It's not babies in incubators, babies beheaded babies.
Babies being beheaded, like the babies in incubators at the time of the Iraq war. So quite clearly somebody, not necessarily our friend from the IDF just there, other people are injecting these lies into the news stream, and they're being picked up, fake news. I don't know, Mariana Spring doesn't seem to have been on the case, really. The BBC pointing out the fact that these were fake. It was quite a good, Jackson Hinkle put quite a good summary of these posts out there, which has done quite well on Twitter. He said they raped women. Unsubstantiated claim that the LA Times has since retracted. They killed a German girl. Well, she's still alive. They put kids in cages. Those were Palestinian children that were being put in cages. They beheaded 40 babies. Israel has denied this claim. And they are basically ISIS. Well, you know, it's always important to remember. In fact, Netanyahu's made a big thing about these people being ISIS. Israel actually backed ISIS in Syria, didn't they?
They did, yeah. I mean, basically, ISIS rebels in Syria were getting rest and recreation and getting medical treatment from the Israeli state. And, of course, the Western powers supported ISIS to try and overthrow Assad. And you see, in the Middle East itself, people have got a much more nuanced and detailed the knowledge of what goes on. In the West, people have no real idea what's going on here if they're not directly involved. So when they're told this is an unprovoked attack by crazy Islamists, blah-de-blah-de-blah, we've got to go to war, and they just go, okay then. But of course, what I would say to many people is what we need now is what the Russians, the Chinese, and others have called for is an immediate ceasefire, leading to negotiations, including hostage swaps and all the rest of it. Immediate ceasefire. And Hamas have actually indicated that they are prepared for an immediate ceasefire. That's what's happened in previous conflicts. But the Israelis now are not going to accept an immediate ceasefire because for political reasons they can't.
Well, will the Americans put any pressure on them to do that?
No, they won't. You see, this is what they should be doing, but they're not doing it. And you can see a big split developing between the, you know, what you might call the Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries and the Western countries. Because the Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries say, we need a ceasefire and a political solution.
Well, we've seen...
And the West is saying, no, we've just got to support the Israelis, whatever they do. Now, if the Israelis over-egg this and kill loads and loads of people in Gaza, more than they've done already, which I think they're going to do, that could kick off World War III, because lots of other countries won't stand for that. The Turks have said they won't stand for it. Hezbollah have said they won't stand for it. The Saudis and the Iranians said they won't stand for it. It's a symbolic thing for all the Muslims all over the world. In Indonesia, people won't stand for it, so there's going to be a world war.
And the Chinese won't stand for it. No. They back the Palestinians. So to what extent would it be? It would certainly be framed as a religious war.
Well, it is a religious war to some extent, because what makes people...
As we've just heard from Deah, as we know, you and I know, that Netanyahu does not represent the Jewish faith by any means at all.
And Hamas doesn't represent all Muslims or all Palestinians. They have got their own views. But Hamas is not ISIS. It's a rather, you know, we could
discuss... Isn't it a little bit like Northern Ireland?
It's
like saying that Northern Ireland was a conflict between Catholics and Protestants. It was actually two different separate groups of people, some of whom were Catholics and some of whom were Protestants. And it seems to me to be a deliberate attempt to frame this as a religious war. But anyway, I did speak to the former Syrian ambassador this week, Peter Ford. It's a longer version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And I tried to be a little bit positive with him, and he said what he thought was the best scenario for the future.
However it pans out, it's going to be very dirty and very messy. The best scenario that Netanyahu could realistically envisage is one where, after bitter fighting, the Israelis emerge as in control of Gaza. But what are they going to do then? What are they going to do then? They were forced to leave already 16 years ago. They didn't leave Gaza because they're such good people and they wanted to be nice. They left because they were afraid. They were afraid of Hamas. They were being harassed. They were losing soldiers. So they cannot stay in Gaza. No, whatever the outcome, it's not good for Netanyahu. And I haven't even gone into the international ramifications, because although at the moment, the Western world is intoxicated, with their new love affair for Israel, but they will soon sober up. This process is already perhaps beginning with the stories of suffering. We're beginning to hear suffering on the part of the Palestinians this time. I think Netanyahu is toast.
Whereabouts do you think this is going? I mean, you've already hinted, this is a unprecedented situation, as far as I understand, for no water, no food, etc., for nearly 2 million people in Gaza. The ultimatum issued by Netanyahu is that all of the hostages which Hamas has taken have to be released before any of the people in Gaza. Now, it does seem that it's almost designed to force anyone that is a pacifist Palestinian to become militant, because unless they do, they're liable to die of thirst or starve. And I don't quite know if anyone in Israel has really thought this through, or maybe they have. Maybe this is a form of, you know, a collective punishment, the sort of thing that we used to see from the Nazis.
Well, Tony, the former head of SIS said, or it was reported yesterday, that he thought that the worst thing Israel could do from its own point of view was to invade Gaza. Not only would they be walking into a trap, a well-prepared trap by Hamas, but they would also be putting Western governments, I use his words, into an impossible position. Now, what he meant by that was that Western governments would have to withdraw their support when the harrowing images emerged of Palestinians dying of hunger and thirst. I mean, even I, who am prepared to believe the absolute worst of our leaders, believe that they would be forced, they would be put in an impossible position to go on supporting Israel. And at that point, Israel would have to stop.
Yeah, so the chap you're talking about, XMI6 chief Tom Porter, he's saying pretty much what you're saying, that there's a trap here, and if the Israelis go in, that is a trap. The alternative is unthinkable. The idea of up to 2 million people being starved to death.
Indeed, it may be what the Israelis initially planned. But now, as the days tick by, I think it's increasingly coming to be seen that that is not practical. And you also have now the international rescue squad on the way. I don't mean the American and now British warships. I mean the serious diplomats. And again, I'm not talking about James Cleverly, obviously. I'm talking about Antony Blinken, who quite cleverly has programmed a series of lightning visits to Arab capitals, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Egypt. All this will impose restraint on Israel. They will not attack without the American green light. And while the Americans are trying to conduct diplomacy, I very much doubt the Israelis would defy them.
The British response has been to send ships and aircraft to support Israel. I don't quite see how ships and aircraft are going to help at all in this situation. So why are they doing that, deploying aircraft and ships to support Israel? A ship, how is that going to help the Israelis in any way? And when I saw that British aircraft were flying over to Israel, I was thinking to myself, what are they going to do? Are they going to be dropping food into Gaza? Are they going to be dropping water supplies somehow into these beleaguered people in this massive prison camp? But no, apparently they're there to just get people out of Israel. And there's a lot of, you know, quite a lot of points in this rather convoluted question, Peter. I'm sorry about that. But also, you know, we've got the situation there where, are they really trying to get people out of this situation? Because there must be many Jews over the decades who've come to Israel now thinking, what am I doing here? Maybe I'd better get out.
It's madness. It's reckless madness. By sending warships and saying that we're sending them in support of Israel, we are in law, international law, making ourselves what they call a co-belligerent. Co-belligerent. Now, this seems fantastic, except that when you're a co-belligerent, it gives the other side the legal right to hit you. So we're making ourselves targets for any party, whether it's at the moment Hamas, maybe tomorrow Hezbollah, maybe Iran, to hit us. And it would be perfectly legal because we are co-belligerents with Israel. you know.
I mean, it does seem to me that, you know, by sending warships, the obvious thing that they're doing is they're saying, well, actually, we don't believe it. This is really just Hamas doing this, for, you know, with some guys with guns, that actually there are big states involved and we might sink their ships.
Well, I'd point out that not just we're making ourselves co-belligerents in the legal sense, but we're also saying to any potential terrorists, come and hit us. We stand shoulder to shoulder with Israel. If you hit us, it will be just as good as hitting Israel. I tell you, Tony, I am advising my own family not to go to big shopping centers that might be targets for terrorists at the moment. Not particularly, don't stand near plate glass, because that's how you're most likely to get hurt. I mean, this is serious. This is serious. We are more or less inviting ISIS, come and hit us, do your worst. We love Israel. That's more important than British lives.
Yeah, this whole idea of what is a terrorist has been interesting. The BBC have been criticised for refusing to call Hamas a terrorist organisation.
Well, this is silly. This is just silly playing with words. And I never myself use the word terror or terrorist, because it's meaningless. Terror is a technique of warfare, and terrorist is just an adjective used to score political points. It doesn't actually mean anything. It's just people we don't like who use violence against civilians. But Israel has used violence against civilians on a daily basis for decades. Are they also, can we call them terrorists? It's meaningless. It's better not to call anybody terrorists.
So that's Peter Ford, the former British ambassador to Syria, giving us his take on it all, Martin. A longer version of that is up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight, where he also talks about some of his experiences in the diplomatic service. But, I mean, there are various points to pick up on there, not least of which, of course, is this warning. He's saying, well, actually, we need to watch out. Maybe there's going to be terror attacks in Britain. If we're going to be weighing in with the Israelis against Hamas and supporting them, you know, maybe not just with words, but also with soldiers, with ships and this sort of thing, then we better watch out.
Well, I mean, we've been dicing with this kind of stuff for years, have we not? I mean, we've had the Labour Party conference at the beginning of this show, and of course it was a Labour government that led us to war in Iraq against the advice of our French and German allies. It's crazy, as Peter Ford points out. And the dangers are palpable, but of course you and I know that a lot of terrorist attacks are actually orchestrated by the deep state in the West. So if something like that does happen, you can't presume that it's simply because we've been lining up with Israel. It'll be because there is a wider agenda, for example, to go to war with Iran. And but you know, when we start seeing that, you know, we can see how things could slide here very easily, because the Hezbollah have made it clear that if there is an attack on Gaza and large numbers of Gazans are dying, they will open a second front in northern Israel.
I find
and
it,
that then opens the Pandora's box to a general Middle East conflict.
I find it quite interesting what Peter's saying about potential blowback here, because MI5 don't seem to have noticed. Their threat level is medium and it hasn't changed.
Well, I think in this country, I think, have you noticed there haven't been any Islamist attacks for ages? Because basically they were run from inside the intelligence structure. So once they decided, when they got rid of Jeremy Corbyn and so on, they don't need to run them anymore. They stopped happening.
It's weird, isn't it? The way these terrorist attacks happen when there's a bit of a political problem like Jeremy Corbyn around. And then as soon as the deep state regains control, like Peter Mandelson has done with the Labour Party and his friends, the terrorist attacks go away, don't they?
That's right. That's right. And of course, the big ones that require a lot more organisation than random people getting together at the back of the mosque or whatever.
Well, we've heard various mentions of the September the 11th attacks. And there is, I think, is it Patrick Berry I've got an interview with him, which I'll pop up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He's a security lecturer at Bath University, saying, this is Israel's 9/11 because more people as a proportion of the population per capita, that phrase we have been using here over the last few weeks, died on Saturday as the American population died on 9/11. Is that legitimate?
Well, civilian people were killed in both cases, but as I said earlier, the people living in these villages next to Gaza are living on the land that the people in Gaza used to own. So they're basically, you know, they're doing what some homeowners do in this country, they kill the burglar. Okay, is that justified? I don't know. But in any case, the 9/11 attack, it was carried out from, this is actually an attack by Hamas, in my view. Even if there was a let it happen on purpose, it's not a made it happen on purpose. 9/11 is an entirely false.
My point is a bit cheeky of the Israelis to say that, since they were one of the major perpetrators of the 9/11 attack.
They are definitely one of the major suspects. That's exactly right.
Anyway, I also spoke to...
Not that many of the people who live around Gaza will have the faintest clue about that.
I also spoke... Well, I mean, I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the excellent article on Wikispooks, 9/11 Israel Did It, All the Proof in the World, which is very well referenced, and it's the article which I think the Reverend Stephen Sizer got booted out of the Church of England for, or at least silenced and told that he wasn't allowed to talk about the Middle East in any of his sermons, which is a bizarre thing to be told by the Church of England. Anyway, we're going now to have a listen to Professor Anthony Hall. He was, in a similar way, he's an academic over in Alberta, Canada, who was treated in a similar way to David Miller, Professor David Miller, Dr. David Miller, whose tribunal, by the way, is next week, who was booted out unceremoniously out of Bristol University for stating a fact, that fact being that the Jewish society at Bristol University was funded through the Israeli embassy. You know, this is a basic fact, and that apparently is anti-Semitic. You're not allowed to say it. But of course, he's going to be appealing that in the employment tribunal here in Bristol County Court next week. So we'll hopefully have some news on that in the next week's show. But Anthony Hall, he was persuaded to leave eventually his university for criticising the 9/11 attacks and for putting up a completely different, much more aligned with our version of what really happened. So I asked him about, particularly about the comparison or by the Israelis of this attack by Hamas last Saturday to 9/11.
The Egyptians are saying 10 days before this happened, they gave the Israelis what they thought was a clear warning, saying, look, Hamas is planning to attack you, and which the Israelis, it seems, have ignored. Well, either the Egyptians are lying or else, I mean, 'cause something went very wrong with the security, didn't it?
And that's all, was similar to 9/11. That United States was getting all kinds of signals that something big was going to happen, and then maybe they wanted it to happen. So I've been listening to Efrat Finnickson, an Israeli woman who was in the IDF, in the intelligence service, and she says it's kind of just inexplicable that this breakout, this prison breakout of Gazans, was able to take place. It took place in at least 15 different parts of the wall that were severed. And she goes into detail. She worked in that area around those walls, and they're very closely monitored. And if a cat goes close to them, for instance, the alert goes off. So it's kind of unthinkable that they would just let the wall be severed, and then the check through points, you know, where say Palestinians are going to go to work in Israel proper, and they have to go through a checkpoint every day. Those checkpoints were left open, and then when people were getting out, there was no IDF response for 5 hours. She kept emphasizing 5 hours, and so she. In her opinion, it's very clear that the Israeli government was in on some kind of understanding that this breakout is wanted. Now we're seeing that it gives the justification for wars and, you know, probably new frontiers of developments culminating maybe in a war in Iran. And that is like 9/11. You make an event happen with the expectation it's going to prepare public opinion and create the atmosphere where you can do things that you couldn't do otherwise. So that's, I think, got to be really closely considered. Now, when you look at Netanyahu's speech, his war speech, I mean, he's talking about, he literally talks about the savages, the Hamas savages, and then he talks about, you know, the ascendance of civilization over savagery. I've written about him as if he's sort of a wannabe Rudyard Kipling, you know, writing about take up the white man's burden, where, you know, there was this Darwinian view of history as a struggle between savagery and civilization, and Kipling was encouraging the British Empire, on behalf of the British Empire, for the United States to take over Philippines and eject the Spanish Empire from the Philippines and become the government of the Philippines, which did happen. So he's saying, you know, the dignity of civilization, if you want to defend civilization from barbarism, fight with Israel against the savages. When Israel wins, you know, all countries who are against barbarism, they win. And, you know, I just cannot see Netanyahu, you know, the primary liar and beneficiary of 9/11. And he did make quite a career out of it. It seemed to me in Paris in 2015 in the Charlie Hebdo situation, he was more or less walking around Paris like the Napoleon of the global war on terror. And, you know, he thinks he's going to try the same thing again based on this manipulation of public opinion and terror, not to say that some real terror hasn't actually happened, but who, you know, what's the dynamics of it
having happened? Well, I mean, just to reiterate, Netanyahu was actually in London at the time of the 7/7 London bombings back in 2005 as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, he seems to always kind of be on the scene. Can we say something about his whole political situation? Because we've had tens of thousands of Jews out on the streets in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem every Saturday since the beginning of the year. Yeah. The banners they're waving are things like crime minister. You know, basically Netanyahu's been indicted for fraud, several cases of fraud. He's now trying to change the constitution so that the Supreme Court can't prosecute him. He's managed to stall these things for a while. And there are quite a few voices from within the country itself saying that this guy is absolutely the least appropriate person to be in charge right now.
Well, there's this heritage of, you know, Israel's a complex place, and there's different views of how it should evolve. Mayor Kahani in the 1980s. Kind of pioneered an approach that Israel should be very, could I say, Jewish supremacist, that Palestinians or Arabs have no place there, that they eventually should be expelled or eliminated one way or another. But certainly in the interim, there should be like no social interaction between the people. I mean, Kahani was so radical. He founded the Jewish Defense League, which was considered to be a terrorist organization in United States and Canada. His Koch party was deemed to be unacceptable in the Knesset, and he, although elected to the Knesset, could not sit in the Knesset because he was deemed by the governing body of the Knesset to be too extreme. So this opinion, this approach, which tends to be among, you know, Orthodox Jews who have a religious interpretation, it's prevalent, and it's developed through this figure called Ben-Gavir, especially, who seems to be really obsessed with building the Third Temple and getting rid of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the, you know, Hamas movement that broke out of prison, call themselves the Aqsa Flood, So this extreme government, and he doesn't want the judges to have any role in it. And of course, he's trying to keep out of prison himself. This resulted in these demonstrations largely for more liberal Jews or Jews that go back to the origins of the spirit of the founding of Israel, which did have some, you know, labor and socialist and even communist dimensions to it, some secular dimensions to it. And that's all gone. And those people were demonstrating and will probably leave Israel. So Netanyahu has presided over a real weakening of Israel. Israel is divided within itself. Israel is not a secure, stable place by any stretch of the imagination. And probably a lot of Jews will want to emigrate from Israel and go somewhere else.
So that's Professor Anthony Hall, Martin. Pretty interesting, I think, particularly talking about what Hamas have done as a kind of prison breakout.
Well, and then lots of people are comparing it to that. And of course, I think to pick up on what he's saying at the end there, the Israeli economy has taken a massive hit as a result of all of this. The stock market's gone down, the shekel's gone down. And of course, Hamas will have done that. That's part of Hamas's
it's
strategy.
It's almost as if.
So, in other words, you can't have a middle class lifestyle around here.
It's almost as if
you want to live in Israel, you're not going to have a middle class lifestyle.
It's almost as if, as simple as this,
you have to go somewhere else for that.
The world is being dragged into a third world war because Benjamin Netanyahu refuses to go to prison.
Well, that's to put too much on one individual, reprehensible as he is. Fundamental to all of this is the West's refusal to face up to the fact that the state of Israel was created by the West in defiance of local opinion, and there's been no attempt whatsoever to balance out the interests of the Palestinians at all. The Oslo Peace Accords, which were signed between Yasser Arafat and Menachem Begin killed loads of civilians, but Yasser Arafat shook his hand and was then, of course, murdered by the Israeli secret services in Polonium, as you said earlier. And the idea was that there was going to be some kind of negotiated solution. The modern Israeli state is quite clear they're not interested in a negotiated solution. That means that the Oslo Accords are history, which means that we're not going to talk about one state, two states here. There's only a one state solution, which will be called Palestine, and some Jews might be allowed to live in it. And you say, well, the Israelis are so powerful, this can't happen. World wars are big. The Algerians, the Algerian Pied Noir, the French Pied Noir who lived in Algeria, they'd lived there for 123 years. The Portuguese settlers in Mozambique and Angola had been there for longer. All of those people, virtually without exception, had to go when the war was over. Israel's only been there for 70 years, and if you're going to have an attitude where you're not going to negotiate, then nobody's going to negotiate with you. It's just end of state of Israel. You've got nuclear weapons, but the Russians have got nuclear weapons. You can't play that card. And ultimately, of course, the Israeli Air Force, if they went head-to-head with the Russian Air Force in Syria, they would lose.
Isn't this one of the reasons why they're trying to sort of bring in, say that all this is Iran that's behind all this? Anyway, look, this is the last of the interviews that I've done specifically on this week. We had that one with Peter Ford, a long version of that will be up on our show page. A very, I thought, particularly fascinating one with Professor Anthony Hall in Canada on this whole situation and connections to other conflicts. And finally this week, it's Greg Felton's turn. He's a English teacher, former journalist, and very much a writer over in Vancouver, Canada, who's written a book called The Host and the Parasite about United States' relationship with Israel. And here he is explaining what he thinks is a connection between what's going on in Israel and Ukraine. In fact, Martin, he said, didn't he, almost as soon as this conflict in Ukraine broke out, that to a certain extent it's opening another front against Russia in Ukraine because the Russians have stymied the West's plan in the Middle East. And so the idea is, right, well, okay, so if the Russians are going to stop us doing what we want in the Middle East, we're going to hit them over in Ukraine.
Well, it's underlying all of this is the fact that it's not just about Israel-Palestine. Two sides are developing. If you look at the way the diplomacy's played out over the last week, the Latin American countries are not supporting sanctions on Russia, and they're not supporting the Western position on this crisis in Gaza. And that's millions of people in Latin America who just don't agree with the West view about
this. We're hearing nothing about this.
Same in Africa, same in Southeast Asia.
We're hearing very little, if anything, about this in the Western press, which is why you're hearing it here. So anyway, let's have a listen to Greg Felton now to explain what he thinks is the links between the conflict in Israel and that in Ukraine.
Russia has warned the United States over and over not to expand NATO eastward. And in 1990, on July the 3rd, such a promise was made to Boris Yeltsin, who was the predecessor of Vladimir Putin. Since then, I think there's been 18 different countries have been accepted into NATO. The United States outright lied to Russia. It lulled them into a false sense of complacency, I think. Because when the Warsaw Pact was dissolved, you had NATO scooping up these countries because they want to encircle Russia with bases to stop Russia from expanding and forcing it to spend money on weapons. The United States, I think the best way to understand this whole scenario is Sergei Lavrov, who is the Russian foreign minister. He gave a speech at the United Nations. And he stated that the United States will never accept a multipolar world. Because once the Soviet Union died, the bipolar world of Russia, Soviet Union, and the United States sort of morphed into the United States, Russia, China. And all those three countries are strong enough to share, to have an influence on the world economy, the world politics. But America is like an immature little brat child who won't share his toys. So America will not allow anything to interfere with its dominance of world politics. And in this case, it's important to know that throughout its history, Russia has been a staunch advocate and supporter of Arab states in the Middle East. And this is something that the Zionists hate. So the Zionists, even though there are Russian oligarchs in Russia that are Jewish, Israel is throwing its weight behind Ukraine, at least rhetorically, because it sees in this a way to undermine Russia. And of course, Israel is very deeply involved in the American corporate culture. So what's good for corporations is good for Israel. The occupation force, I refuse to call it a defense force, cannot afford to. And what I think Haaretz came out with a good article that showed Israel is going to pay a terrible price for its ruthless massacre of the Palestinians. I mean, the one thing, see, the great failure of Israel, the consummate failure of its treatment of the Palestinians, is that it's already gone as low as it can go. Torture, murder, starvation, deprivation of employment. It can't do any worse. But the more it goes down that path, it has nothing. There's no upside for Israel. All it can do is kill. That's all it knows. It's a parasitic virus that sucks the life out of the entire human race. And it is infecting Palestine even more than normal. The more it goes, and you're quite right, the more sympathy the Palestinians will gain, despite the dogma and the sycophantic behavior of governments. Already the British government is telling the Football Association to express sympathy for Israel. And how many Muslims are playing in the Premier League? I don't think that's going to happen. Even the European Union, which reflexively cut off aid to the Palestinians, was stood on its ear by the Spanish and the French. And so the EU is having to rethink its anti-Palestinian reaction. Ironically, this might end up benefiting Palestine to some degree, because it just shows the limits of Israeli rhetoric, Israeli propaganda. What we are seeing is the true face of Israel, a cancerous, murderous, illegal occupation state that was never legitimate in the first place. Well, and every country that is going to concoct sophistries to justify Israeli terrorism is going to have to pay a penalty.
Well, I just find Greg's analogies, Martin. I mean, he's pointing out a almost forgotten fact there, that Russia is has always been, since the end of the Second World War, the Soviet Union anyway, associated with the Arab states, for example, with their military base in Syria, etc. So is there a connection, do you think, between this battle going on in Gaza and the sort of new Cold War?
Yes, of course. I mean, as I was saying earlier, the two sides are shaping up in the global battleground that's developing. I think, just to correct, he said he thinks Friedland's Jewish. I don't think she's Jewish. She's an ethnic Ukrainian, which is why she's so pro-Ukrainian. Apart from being a nasty piece of work for other reasons and so on, this conflict isn't just about Israel and Palestine. It's part of a general conflict which has been going on for quite a long time now. And it is, you know, the Russians are in Syria as we speak. They weren't in Syria in that kind of way in the 1970s. But when the Syrian army went into Lebanon during the Lebanese Civil War in the 1980s, there was a serious fear that Russian SAM missiles would be used to shoot down a US plane over Syria, and both sides withdrew to try and back down. We're now much closer to, there's so many flashpoints between Russia and the West. It's not just in the Ukraine. The Ukraine is only one piece of the war. And there's a world war developing between the developing world, what used to be the colonies of the British Empire and the other empires in Europe, and the rest. China and Russia used to be dominated by the outside forces of Western imperialism. So did India, so did most of Africa, so did Latin America. And all of those countries are now lining up against the residual Western power represented by the financial shenanigans of the City of London and Wall Street and the Pentagon backing it all
just
up.
Just to wind up, I mean, we're kind of confronted now with this situation where a standoff with the Israelis saying that they're going to go into Gaza. They're saying there will be no humanitarian aid into Gaza until the captives are released. That is unlikely to happen. It's almost as if they've made an ultimatum which has got no basis in reality.
Yeah, and if they go into Gaza, they're going to get a hell of a fight, aren't they? And of course, Hezbollah has already said, if they go into Gaza, they're going to open up another front in northern Israel, which is why the Israeli army can't be deployed to invade Gaza, because they've got to protect northern Israel from being attacked by Hezbollah. And Hezbollah's rockets are much more accurate than Hamas's rockets, and they will knock out all the infrastructure in Israel. They can bomb Lebanon and kill loads of people in Lebanon, but that then brings Iran into the war and potentially the Russian Air Force into the war. You see, they've had air superiority for all these years. But it's not clear that they would be able to retain air superiority. And don't forget, from inside Siberia, the Russians have now got Kinzhal missiles, which can hit anything, anywhere on Earth, within 25 minutes. So that aircraft carrier and those two ships we've sent, those two British ships could just be annihilated just like that.
Haven't the Russians just announced a new kind of nuclear-powered missile that can go even quicker?
That's right.
The world?
They've basically got everything they need to fight a war. They don't have to go anywhere to do it. They can fire from their own territory anywhere in the world, and some of the missiles have got to go through Antarctica to hit the United States. So they fired from Russia under Antarctica, hits the United States within 25 minutes. And so, you know, the dangers here are absolutely palpable. This is another straw on the camel's back to World War III.
Where are we going to be next week then? Do you think we Israelis will go in there?
I think what Peter Ford was saying earlier is probably right. They'll have second thoughts about it, because all that will happen is that it's like Brer Rabbit and the Tar Baby, isn't it? Now, what I thought they might do is open the Raqqa crossing into Egypt and then just drive the Palestinians into Egypt. But they don't want to do that. And the Egyptians won't accept it either. The Egyptians don't want the Palestinians.
I mean, Netanyahu is in trouble. Antiwar.com's reporting a majority of Israelis are actually blaming the government for the Hamas attack. The poll says 56% of respondents want Netanyahu out.
Well, there you are. And I think that there's also a lot of bloodthirsty determination to punish the Palestinians. But what they're going to do is carry on bombing them and starving them.
Be careful what you wish for, because you could get some even more right-wing person in there.
Well, you could. I mean, the problem with these kind of situations is the more extreme people feed on the more extreme behaviour of the other side, and on it goes, and who's to put a stop
it's
to
almost
it?
Almost like they're trying to, up the ante as much as they possibly can. Anyway, look, it was quite serendipitous, really, for David Halpin to be talking about Lawrence of Arabia last week. And he mentioned this film called Lawrence After Arabia. I find it absolutely riveting in a way, the way the British have been so involved in all this over the years. I mean, we have our previous generations, Martin, in this country have set this situation up, haven't we?
We are the British Empire was a key element in the creation of the modern globalised world, and virtually every conflict on virtually every continent has a British dimension to
so
it.
So cleverly, Starmer, Thornbury, what's his name, that guy from the Bilderberg, I can't even remember his name, the Labour foreign spokesperson, what's his name? David Lammy, all of them going, oh, we are four square behind Israel. Actually, they are the ones that were, the British are the ones who were in charge of the welfare of the Palestinians. And many of the British police and soldiers that were over there during the Second World War, at the end of the Second World War, that handed the state over to the Israelis, were being killed and shot at by the Israeli terrorists. So, of course,
the Israeli terrorists also killed loads and loads of civilians. But far from being punished, they were treated as statesmen. And that's exactly, Hamas see their road to power in Palestine as exactly the same as Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir saw their role in the 40s. We will be forgiven by the world because we are strong enough to get what we want, and everybody will shake our hands and recognise our state. The Hamas have got exactly the same strategy. It's ruthless. It's horrible, but we're not necessarily going to lose because we've killed loads of civilians. The Israelis have shown us that you can win and do that.
Yeah, there is this kind of hijacking of the whole idea of Judaism as part of this Israeli state, which really I just find so appalling. And the idea of what you're doing is you're also hijacking the memory of the Holocaust as well, in order to try to say that you're only doing this because of what the Nazis did in the Second World War, etc. But anyway, look, let's go back to Lawrence of Arabia briefly, because we've got a clip now from the trailer for this amazing film, Lawrence After Arabia, which looks at his apparent accident, which is much more likely, it seems to me now, after hearing from David Halpin, to be him being assassinated before the Second World War, because he was getting very annoyed that the Arabs, who he'd been working very closely during the First World War, were being sold down the river by the British Foreign Office.
He is still stirring up the Arabs. He's pissing off the Jews in Palestine and buggering up our control of the Suez Canal. Now, if somebody isn't going to annihilate this little shit, then I will!
Known at the time of his death as Thomas Edward Shaw, better known to the rest of the world as Colonel Lawrence of Arabia. None of the other witnesses observed a car. Could you have been mistaken, perhaps?
No, sir.
So that's a clip from the film Lawrence After Arabia, which is out there, folks, if you want to have a watch of it. But Martin, this is important, isn't it? The British responsibility for all of this.
Well, it is, but most people today would they've got a different life, and they think all of this is just the past. But the past doesn't go away; it continues to fester until the various conflicts that have been created in the past are dealt with in some serious fashion. And Britain. We've allowed the Hong Kong Chinese to come here because they're being oppressed by the terrible Chinese Communist government. What about all these stateless Palestinians in Gaza? Maybe they should come here because it was the British Empire that created the State of Israel. We're responsible for it.
Okay, so we'll wind up with another clip from last week's interview with David Livingstone. Now, I don't know if you managed to hear the whole thing last week. It was certainly up there. The Nazis on acid, or Nazis and acid, was the title I chose for that. But he's well known for his book on transhumanism. His latest article was about the use of psychedelics by the CIA, those ideas being around with the Nazis too, which I find quite fascinating. The idea also in that interview is we were exploring was this idea of the normalization of schizophrenia. And that becoming kind of almost something which is cool. It's great, but even though that actually drives everybody nuts, that doesn't seem to matter anymore. So let's have a listen to our final clip tonight is hearing David explaining a bit about transhumanism, what it really is.
Simply put, their public image is that they want to improve humanity, augment humanity, right? So they want to use whatever technologies are available to improve humans. To make them live longer, to make them stronger, to make them, more intelligent. So like things like smart drugs, nanotechnology, all kinds of things like that.
mRNA vaccines, maybe.
Yeah, and vaccines, presumably, yeah. And I would say that, the way to best understand it is the best explanation that I've seen of what transhumanism is the movie Lucy with Scarlett Johansson. And Lucy has multiple meanings, right? Lucy is Lucy, which is the skeleton that what was his name? The archaeologist discovered. So Lucy is also when I think the Beatles, when they wrote their song "Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds," they made a reference. They were making an overt reference to Lucy, but also Lucy then stands for LSD, right? So basically, in the movie, she takes a smart drug until she becomes so intelligent that she can merge with the internet. And so that's kind of, I find it hard to explain or understand, but this is how somehow these parallel paths are related to each other. But this is why they want to, ultimately they want to create this global brain, which is, knowingly compared to the all-seeing eye of Freemasonry, which is a computer that will be like a god because it will see everything and know everything. So it will be an artificial, very powerful artificial intelligence that will have access to the totality of human knowledge, as well as every activity, every transaction, where everything, everything people, everything anywhere, anyone is doing anywhere. And, so that, I can't explain how they see it, but they have this bizarre idea that they are going to be, because they think that the human mind is a biological computer.
Right.
And so that it operates on a kind of program. So that the human personality is like a biological program, and that they will actually be able to replicate it and then sort of, just toss it into an AI where it will live forever.
Well, how about that? How about that for being bonkers? It's a fascinating interview that I'll probably put I will definitely put another version of that, or the same version from last week, because he takes us through into such interesting areas. Does David Livingstone, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, and also his original book, I think the first one he wrote actually was called The Dying God, which is a kind of play on words where you're looking at the original kind of Neolithic god, the Canaanite god, which was the sun, which dies every night and is resurrected every morning. But also this idea of the Gnostics infiltrating and taking over the various Abrahamic faiths and then shutting them down, effectively. And that being their main aim. And of course, he talks a lot about Albert Pike, which is one thing we haven't mentioned this week, is this whole concept of starting a religious war in the Middle East between the Zionists and the Muslims. And the overall effect of it is supposed to be to get everyone to hate religions, and to hate faiths. And that's why they're spending all this time and effort, it seems to me, in occupying those faiths to steer them, down the drain so that the world will hate them and then they'll bring in their faith. So anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Dia Moodley, and also to, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Plus, of course, sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do have some poems from Patrizia this week, just not time to read them out, but do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic at Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us at the Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
He was in agony when he prayed in Gethsemane, for the price was to pay seemed too much for him. He contemplated the price to be paid for humanity, and even the Almighty turned his back at him. They used to love to stay with the master, but now they can see that him a disaster. The ones who cried Hosanna, Hosanna, same ones who led him straight to Golgotha. Judas was too quick to betray him, Peter couldn't wait to deny him. The world at large will reject him, tell me what you wanna do to him. But why didn't the Jews know he's the King of Kings? When even the stars and the kings know he's the King of Kings. The sun and the moon was his authority, because he told them once and they be standing still. They hung him high, stretched him wide, he hung his head and then he died. But that's not how the story ends. And but thought the heroes again.
Jesus Christ the Son. Oh yes, oh yes, hallelujah, he arose. Oh yes, oh yes, hallelujah, he arose. The Prince of Peace arose. Hallelujah, he arose. Oh yes, oh yes, Jesus Christ the Son of God. Oh yes, oh yes, hallelujah, he arose.
Why do you seek for the living among the dead? Though he died like a lamb, but he's still not dead. Cause even in the grave, he's got over death. Now we have the victory over death. I see an angel of the Lord come down from heaven and roll us to the world like a little pebble. Oh, in the King of Glory, the Lord was strong and mighty. He arose. Death, where is that victory? He arose. Where is that sting? He arose. They hung him high, stretched him wide, he hung his head and then he died. But that's not how the story ends, on the top the heroes again.
Jesus Christ the Son of God. Oh yes, oh yes, hallelujah, he arose.
Oh
when the sun refused to shine upon this awful scene. And humanity has lost hope, because all they saw was the cross and his bleeding victim. Their future seemed to be darkened with despair as they watched him laid in the tomb, hands folded on his breast, his eyes shut and his lips seeming forever silent. They watched as a heavy stone was rolled against the entrance of the tomb, and a guard of 100 soldiers around the sepulchre. Permit me to say, Jesus was very dead, but that was not how the story ended. For 3 days later, early Sunday morning, there was a mighty earthquake, for an angel of the Lord has descended from the heavens, his eyes as lightning, and his raiment as white as snow. For the fear of him, the guards did shake and fall down like dead men. Brave soldiers that have never been afraid of human power, taking captives without sword or spear. For the face that they beheld today was not the face of a mortal warrior, but the face of the captain of the Lord's army, the power of his resurrection. They watched as he rolled away the heavy stone, as one would roll away a tiny pebble, and Jesus stepped out of the grave proclaiming, "Oh death, where is thy sting? Oh grave, where is thy victory? Open up your gates and let the King of Glory come on in." Who is the King of Glory? He's the Lord God, strong and mighty. Who is the King of Glory?
Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Yes, oh yes. Hallelujah, he arose. Oh yes, oh yes. Hallelujah, he arose. The Prince of Peace arose. Hallelujah, he arose. Oh yes, oh yes. Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Oh yes, oh yes. Hallelujah, he arose. Oh.